It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. A great show for you. Cory Doctorow, long-lost friend of the TWiT, is back from craphound.com and boingboing.net. Also, Larry Maggot of CBS and Jason Heyer from Tech Republic will talk about the latest news, including a big breaking story. It looks like Sprint has been sold. All the details coming up next on TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Audio bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by the new Winamp for Android, featuring wireless sync and one-click iTunes import. Now with free daily music downloads and full-length CD listening parties. Download it for free at winamp.com/android. Video bandwidth for TWiT is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 375, recorded October 14th, 2012. Beware of the leopard. This Week in Tech is brought to you by GoToMeeting with HD Faces from Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients anywhere in the world. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code TWIT. And by Carbonite Online Backup, automatic, continuous, unlimited backup for your computer files, just $59 a year. Try it free at Carbonite.com and use the offer code TWIT to get 2 bonus months with purchase. And by the new Squarespace. Squarespace introduces a new content management system, making it faster and easier to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. Plus more than 50 new features, including mobile responsive designs. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, go to squarespace.com. Use the offer code TWIT10. And by FreshBooks, the easy cloud accounting service for small business that saves time and gets you paid faster. Join over 5 million FreshBooks users and try the service free for 30 days of unlimited use at freshbooks.com. Be sure to let them know you heard about it on TWIT. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show that covers the tech news of the week. And we've got a great panel for you, starting to my left with Larry Maggot of CBS and Larry'sWorld.com. Larry does tech reports for CBS Radio and is a regular with us. Hey, Larry, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Nice to, from his studio in San Francisco. Or no,
Palo Alto.
Palo Alto. All right.
Close enough.
Much
close
better. Enough. Much yep. better. Also here, Jason Heyer, who is from Tech Republic, and his studio in, are you in Knoxville?
Louisville, Kentucky.
Louisville.
Louisville.
Yes,
Louisville. Nice to have you
yes,
back,
sir.
Jason. And a guy we
Always
get to talk to not nearly enough, because normally he's on British Standard Time, Cory Doctorow of craphound.com, great author, science fiction author, just a cool guy and, you know, an advocate for all the things that are right and good with this world, an enemy of all that is bad.
Ha.
Corey's in the U.S. This week touring around your new book.
Yep, Pirate Cinema. I'm in my hotel room in New York where the Ethernet cable only reaches to the bed, which is why I'm sitting in bed.
Oh, but it's a beautiful view. It looks like you've got Central Park and wet behind
That's
you.
Right. Yeah, no, it's just it's a crappy motel room picture.
No, it looks – don't tell us that. You've ruined it.
What is a great picture.
What is Pirate Cinema? Is it – now, the you've written both – young adult novels and adult novels and lots of nonfiction. You know, it was one of the happiest days of my life when my daughter, who was in high school at the time, gave me your book on content.
Mm.
She didn't know that I knew you. And I thought, oh. I have high hopes for Abby. That's great.
Oh, that's
that was
nice.
Her Christmas present.
Yeah. Little Brother's a young adult novel. I actually had an adult novel come out about a month ago that I wrote with Charles Stross called Rapture of the Nerds. But this is a young adult novel, and it's about kids in the UK who live in a regime where if you are accused of infringing copyright 3 times, they take away your internet access. And this destroys their families when it happens.
You know, that could never happen. What are you talking
seriously,
about?
Yeah. Given that AT&T leaked plans to do basically that today. It's coming. And so after destroying their family's lives, they run away in shame to London, and they form a kind of semi-joke anarchist freegan filmmaker youth gang and devote themselves to destroying the entertainment industry using the only weapon they've ever really mastered, which is piracy. So they make their own movies, and they show them in cemeteries and in old sewers they break into and turn into movie theaters. But they also pirate in a way calculated to cost as much money as possible to the entertainment industry, and, you know, hilarity ensues.
Do you hope that this will actually inspire a whole group of teenagers to do exactly this?
No, you know what I hope it'll do is that I hope it'll inspire a group of teenagers and maybe adults to understand and to demand that the internet be regulated as more than a cable TV system. That they start thinking about the internet as, you know, the lifeline to free speech, free press, freedom of assembly, access to health and employment and all the rest of it. And just like reject the idea that, you know, it's somehow proportionate that if you're accused of watching TV the wrong way, we take away all of that.
Yeah.
Hear, hear.
Hear, hear is right.
Thank you.
It's always great to have Corey on. We're going to actually interrupt briefly because we've got a phone call to make to Roswell, New Mexico. So I don't know if you – did you guys watch this morning when Felix Baumgartner jumped out of a weather balloon and set a new record for the highest free fall, 24 miles high? We tried to get Felix, but he was napping. He was drained. He was drained after his adventure. No, Felix is, of course, long gone, but and doing, I'm sure, interviews with larger networks. But we were able to talk to Scott Gillies, who actually is from a technical point of view, maybe as interesting. He's the guy who brought us those amazing pictures. 8 million people watched live on YouTube, setting easily a new record for a number of concurrent views. The previous record was set during the Olympics in London of 500,000. So that's a big jump.
It would have been bigger in London, but so many of them were being detained at the time.
Yeah. let's go to New Mexico and say hello to Scott Gillies. We recorded this earlier. This is Leo Laporte, Scott, the host of the show.
Hey,
is Felix there, or is he not available?
He is long gone.
He's long gone. He's taking a nap.
Yeah, well, I don't know what he's gone from the side. He's probably not napping yet. He's had a really exciting day. So
I think so. Maybe his heart's still pounding. Mine is. So, Scott, what did you do there?
Well, I did basically a technical production oversight. So,
you know, it was amazing. We were watching the video, and by the way, I don't know if you know, but a YouTube record, 8 million people were watching the video.
Yeah, it's great. We always, you know, dreamed it would be this big, but wasn't really sure what the exact impact would be, and I think a lot of people were interested in Felix's story and his goal, and it was amazing footage. We had a fantastic team of people working for us and with us, and I think it exceeded our wildest dreams, to be honest with you.
The quality of the video from the capsule was remarkable. How did that work?
Well, we basically built a flying studio. We had a great partner, Flightline Films, who helped design, and Radial Communications, who basically worked over the last 4 years to develop the system to transmit all these pictures back down in real time, and they were stunning, as you all saw.
No kidding. Now it's 24 miles up. It was a high def picture. It was crystal clear. What kind of cameras were there in the capsule?
We had big range cameras from Lux HD cameras, which is a third-inch chip CCD camera, and we had red cameras.
Oh, wow. So you were shooting you were shooting 5K up there, too.
It was 4K.
4K.
It wasn't the epics, but and we had, of course, Canon still cameras as well.
And how were you controlling those?
It's a custom control software that was developed by Riedel on Flightline to control all the cameras and switch all of them live remotely via radio.
Wow. Mike, was there a microwave link back down? I mean, how was he able to get that?
Yeah, several microwave links.
Okay.
So it's pretty amazing. But, you know, nothing, I would say that a civilian company has done in a long time. You know, outside of NASA, this is a pretty bold endeavor, and we're really proud to have pulled this off and worked with such great partners.
No kidding. It looked like a GoPro camera out his out in front of him. Is that accurate? Or
yes. So we had on his actual body. We had GoPro cameras on his body.
So there's a lot of footage that you've recovered since. What happens to the capsule, by the way? Is that still up there?
Capsule, the capsule came down safely, and it drops like any. So we've recovered that. We've recovered all the footage from Felix and from the capsule. And now we're just basically trying to go through all the terabytes of footage that we and still images that we have. So there's a lot more to come. And, of course, a documentary on BBC to be aired in the next few weeks. And we're just really excited that it's can't tell you the feeling. It's like nothing else I've ever worked on. It's truly a great experience. You know, I've worked on a lot of sporting events and news events, but it really exceeds those expectations. It's unbelievable.
What was the feeling on the ground? And you're watching as we are, when he kind of leans forward and just falls out.
Yeah.
What did it feel like?
It speaks for itself, really. I mean, you know, from my perspective, it's we wanted the world to judge, and we wanted Felix to be happy with all the images, and it was, you know, personally, it was very exciting and unbelievable, and heart wrenching.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, yeah,
just kind of amazing. Felix Baumgartner, 128,000 feet, 24 miles high, the longest free fall. In history. He did, I guess we heard in the press conference, break the sound barrier.
Yeah, that's still to be verified officially, but yeah, that's preliminary data.
Unbelievable. So now what do you do, Scott? You got an editing job, I guess.
Editing and packing and shipping.
Well,
out of here.
I appreciate you. Where are you exactly? Is it in the desert? Where are you exactly?
Roswell, New Mexico.
So that's kind of a desert area.
Yes.
Area 51.
I don't know if Area 51 was here, but it's a really great
Roswell's
town.
Famous
to be honest with you, we've learned to really love Roswell and the people.
That's great.
Very supportive and accommodating to us. So
that's great.
It's quite a nice place, and everyone should probably visit Roswell.
Scott, I cannot thank you enough for taking time. I'm sure you have many, many things to do, and I won't keep you any longer, but congratulations on the success of the jump. Congratulations to Felix and on setting a new YouTube record by a factor of 16, the 8 million live simultaneous views. I don't think anybody knew that that was even doable. It's truly amazing.
It was. And you know, I just want to say really, there's a huge team here at Red Bull. That's, you know, so many people that it's hard to mention everyone. Unbelievable, starting with Felix down, you know, the team at Sage Cheshire who, you know, really envisioned this whole project, and for Red Bull and its owner who, you know, went through many years of perseverance to pull this off. It's quite incredible. So I don't want to take any personal credit for it. It's fantastic, and we're really happy everyone enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. That's Scott Gillies, in charge of the technical production for what was quite something to see. You know, what's interesting to me, and I don't know if you guys want to comment on this, but it seems that got much more, a guy jumping out of a balloon got more attention than Discovery landing on Mars.
Yeah.
And which disheartened me a little bit, but then I realized why, because it's a human being. And unmanned space exploration just doesn't galvanize the imagination in the same way. And yet, I'd love I'd love to see Red Bull sponsor the next Discovery.
Yeah.
Curiosity, I should say.
Yeah. Why does reality TV get more, you know, more traffic and user interest than, you know, Jim Lair on PBS, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's true that this guy certainly got a lot of press, but I think it depends on kind of which bubble you're inhabiting. Like, it didn't really make a ripple here. I was at Comic-Con, and, you know, it wasn't on the giant Jumbotron in the big hall. Yeah, no, I mean, it. You know, people were watching the people dancing the hip-hop rhythm game more than the... Whereas, you know, I saw the Curiosity landing at NASA Ames, where they invited in the general public, and it was, you know, rammed all their big lawns, just filled with people and these huge Jumbotrons and scientists and their neighbors all just sitting there just screaming their heads off when the 7 minutes of hell finally concluded. So I think it might – I mean, clearly the numbers on YouTube were very big. But well, I wonder to what extent this is a global phenomenon the way Curiosity was.
Two events had in common, of course, is the fact that finally some good news, some exciting. And what the jump had was we were all wondering whether he'd make it. I mean, let's face it. This was a dangerous mission. And until he landed on his feet, we weren't sure that it was going to be successful. And
mission might even be it. Mission's a very charitable name for it. Stunt might be right.
I mean, well, it's not exactly a mission.
Cool. it wasn't exactly Evel Knievel jumping over a bunch of buses. I mean, this was a pretty sophisticated technological accomplishment as well as a very gutsy guy. You have to give him credit a lot more into this.
He wasn't bringing like vaccine to a, you know, a distant colony that, you know, facing a superbug or anything.
I think stunt's the right word for it. But nonetheless, you can marvel at it. And as you know, was true. And if you were watching the video of it, I mean, it was quite remarkable. The quality of the video. When I first tuned it in on YouTube, I was kind of stunned. It's like, wow, this is a good picture for 25 miles.
That was the story, I think, right? And they were using 4K cameras.
It's
wow. You know, I mean, the quality of this is unbelievable.
And it does look, he's wearing a spacesuit. There's certainly the semiotics of it they were very aware of, right? It looks like a space capsule. He's in a spacesuit, you know. You can see the curvature of the Earth. I mean, I guess 24 miles up is probably space.
It's the edge of space.
The edge of space.
He totally must have gotten at least 4 bars on his phone, too.
That's where I have to go to get 4 bars. Not around here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. He's not allowed to use a Kindle or a cell phone in space. That's against the rules.
This could have been P.T. Barnum, right? I mean, it had that kind of slickness to the whole packaging of it. So kudos from that perspective.
Yeah, I don't want to deprecate it.
Awesome.
It was a big Red Bull ad, but you know, it's pretty cool. I wouldn't do it.
I wonder if you're allowed to drink like lots of diuretics like Red Bull before you put on your spacesuit and 25,000 feet.
Seems
up
like
jump.
It was a 4-hour ascent in that capsule on the weather balloon. I would think he was not drinking Red Bull before. I mean, your heart's beating fast enough, I'm sure.
No need for a
stimulus.
With all spacesuits, it depends.
Yeah. Wah. 5 years in the making. A lot of technology. I love it that he lands standing. Again, they're very aware of the symbology. This looks like NASA mission, doesn't it?
Yeah. Right. Not enough Mohawks.
Totally. Yeah. No Mohawks.
Or Max.
It doesn't say stunt control. It says mission control.
That's right.
Did it say mission control?
Yeah, it did.
It totally did.
Okay. Well, there you go.
They should have called themselves like Rabassa, Red Bull,
Aerial Stunt Team. Yeah. Rabast.
Of course, you know, it could have all been done in a studio, just like the moon landing. That is a possibility.
Yeah, I want to hear what Adam Curry has to say about that. He could say the whole thing was faked. I think he probably believes that.
Well, everybody knows that the skies are the stars are hung in a firmament just, you know, above the Chrysler building.
Right, right. And the Earth is, in fact, not revolving around the sun. It's the other way around. And anybody who says otherwise is just not paying attention. Did you see Saturday Night Live skit last night? That was the other that was the other big story.
Oh, yeah. CNET got a good plug.
Yes. Totally. CNET, Wired, and Gizmodo. Yeah. So I'm not going to play it because NBC will immediately pull this podcast down from YouTube forevermore. They just have that. We get that every week. And it's just too much trouble. So I'm just going to leave this as an exercise for the listener. A Saturday Night Live skit. It was called Tech Talk. The female host introduced three nerds, and they really weren't nerdy, from CNET and Gizmodo and Wired. And the show starts with them whining about the iPhone. Well, the maps, by the way, exactly as we have been doing for the last 2 weeks. The maps progress, terrible. The thing has dings. And by the way, it does have, mine's dinged up like crazy. And what was the third person? Oh, the apps take too long to load or something like that.
Right.
And then, and the flare. If you point the camera at the sun, you get a purple flare. I don't like it.
I
want to take pictures of the sun better.
All of these are accurate depictions of how people were whining about the iPhone 5. Accurately or not accurately, the maps program is pretty bad. You do get a purple flare. But then I thought this was really, actually, I thought it was kind of inspired. She introduces the three people from the Shenzhen plant in China that made the iPhone. And the pundits immediately say, oh, can we leave now? No, it's a trap, she said. and the Chinese workers break out a Chinese violin and do the dance of sarcastic dance of misery. And it was actually very pointed, talking about, frankly, the issue that geeks would love to, you know, talk about the iPhone, but really don't want to talk about how it's made or where it comes from.
Or the fact that these are first world problems to the ultimate
very
degree.
I mean, first world.
Very much so. I mean, I did a piece right after this whole started called Gripes Follow Hype. So before the iPhone, we all hype it and make a ridiculously big deal about this phone, which after all is a phone. Same could be said, by the way, for the new iPad mini. It's just a tablet. And then after it comes out, we make a huge deal about every tiny imperfection that we can possibly find. And neither the hype nor the gripes have anything to do with reality. Well, they have something to do with reality, but they're way out of perspective. But that's what we do.
Not me. I didn't even know that.
Not you. Not Gary says, not me. I'm not involved.
Not you, Leo. You don't do that.
No, I do it. In fact,
we all do.
It would be as if you complained that, gee, ESPN spends an awful lot of time talking about baseball. This is all we do. So it's not like there are other things I could talk about. And we certainly do talk about conditions at Foxconn and so forth. We have many times in the past. But, in fact, we've even debated the issue, should we be promoting the consumerism involved in, you know, getting a new phone every year or two and the high costs to the people who make the phone and so forth. We talk about that. But I admit, we also talk a lot about the purple flare.
Wouldn't it be awesome if someone started making consumer electronics where the duty cycle and the material properties were sort of in harmony with one another? So a device that you're intended to replace every 18 months was designed to gracefully degrade back into the part stream every 18 months, rather than being made out of materials that'll last like, you know, 100,000 years in a landfill.
That's crazy talk, Corey.
I know.
I've seen your laptops, by the way.
they do degrade. Only last about 18 months. But you know, when I one of the ways that I was able to quit smoking was by the realization that I was spending a laptop a year on cigarettes.
Wow.
And so now I buy myself a laptop every year.
Yeah.
And I don't smoke.
And you put Linux on it.
Nice.
And I put Linux on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ubuntu.
What's your laptop currently? Are you still using Lenovo's?
X220, ThinkPads. It's for the warranty because they'll do the on-site next-day hardware replacement anywhere that IBM Global Services has an office. So it's like it costs as much as AppleCare, except a highly skilled technician will come to your hotel room and fix it the day after it breaks.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
and they don't look at it and say, oh, I'm sorry you've put Ubuntu on this.
No, totally not. And in fact, because the hard drive comes out with one screw, I'm like, well, you know, assuming I'm back at my office, I'm like, I had the original drive here because I always throw the hard drive out and put a big SSD in. I've got the original hard drive here. I can stick it in and boot it up. I'm not going to click through the EULAs. That can be your job, but you can see that it still doesn't work.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Never clicked a Microsoft EULA.
Really?
Yeah.
Since when? Since ever?
Well, since at least not at the OS level. I've certainly clicked some app level EULAs,
and
but
is
never
that,
an OS
is that
EULA.
More is that more a statement, or do you actually worry about what you're agreeing to?
There was one day when I realized it. It's kind of like uptime on a server. It's like, you know, I reboot the server whenever it needs it, and then one day you go, wait a second, this server hasn't been rebooted in like 22 months. I'm never rebooting this server. And from then on, it's like, you know, is there any way I can patch the kernel without having to reboot it? So, yeah. So at a certain point, you're like, you know what? I've never clicked a EULA on this. When we got a Wii when my wife was pregnant. And in the last couple of weeks when we were just sort of, she was a little overdue. We were kind of hanging around the house and I went out and got a Wii. And we didn't actually unwrap it until after my daughter was born. And then the EULA comes up, and I'm like, you know, I've got someone around the house who's not legally competent to form a contract. I should get her to click the link. So I got my newborn daughter, and I clicked the link. I've got a photo of it. It's pretty good. It's in my Flickr stream.
No, sir, I did not agree to that EULA. Wow.
It's, you know, the many That's uses great. You can put your children to around the house.
This is good. Yeah, you can't let Posey grow up now. You've got to keep her That's around. Right. Anyway, it's interesting that there was so much attention on this Tech Talk skit. I think there's a little guilt, little first word guilt in here. But what do we do about it?
Well, it's such a part of our culture, right? I mean, you know, electronics, tech is it's what this says is something that, you know, we've seen over the past couple years is really that mainstream media has embraced technology and realizes that it has become such a part of everyday life. It's become such a part of consumers' buying habits, of course, but also just the usage habits of everyone. And especially smartphones and tablets have taken that, I think, deeper to younger ages and older ages, to the point where, you know, they're addicted to technology and it's such a part of everything they do. And so obviously our industry in terms of technology journalism has grown and adapted and, you know, raised the tenor of the conversation, or I should say raised the, maybe not the level of it, but the noise level. And so this is, I think this is just representative of that, of the fact that this stuff is just absolutely everywhere now.
I think it's also Apple. I think Apple, for some reason, brings about a fascination on the part of mass media. I understand that because I'm in mainstream media, and the level of interest from anything or for anything Apple so far exceeds the level of interest for anything else.
So let me ask you. So, in fact, we have the same issue. Windows 8 comes out next week. Or a week from Thursday. You're going to be there waiting in line, covering it, talking to people waiting in line for Windows 8, the first Windows 8 machines, the CBS saying, Larry, we've got to get a man on the street for Windows 8.
Yeah, right. We're going to be waiting in line in front of the Microsoft store in Times Square. You know, we'll cover it, obviously. There's interest in it. But it's not going to get the kind of coverage that any Apple event would get by an order of magnitude. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily the right way to go, but I know the interest level on the stations, and it just isn't there, frankly. It's there a little bit, but not to the extent of Apple.
You can't.
Well, there's a reason why Microsoft has been so coy about, you know, they haven't even said when it's officially released. I mean, they haven't done a big push and said this is when it's released. They still haven't told us how much it is. All of that is Apple envy and Apple you know, emulation, right? I mean, they're trying to create that same kind of buzz. They're not doing it particularly well, but by withholding the price, you know, they're still keeping us talking about it. And so that is working for them to a degree. And I do think there is a certain level of excitement and interest there for the Microsoft Surface. And I think there will be a lot of hype about it the week that it comes out. Now it looks like it is coming out midnight, the day of
25th, 26th.
Yeah, 25th, 26th, right? So I think there will be a lot written about it. There probably will be people in line. There probably will be,
on, Jason. Nobody's going to wait in line for Windows RT.
But what are you going to wait in line for?
For Surface. The Surface tablet, not for Windows, certainly.
Let's take a break and come back. I want to talk about this. In fact, we have the first Windows 8 ad, which Microsoft has started airing, which looks an awfully lot like an Apple ad, but we'll show you that in a second. Jason Heiner is here from Tech Republic. Great to have you, Jason, from Louisville, home of the Slugger.
That's right.
Cory Doctorow of craphound.com and Boing Boing, Boing creator of the Boing Boing, boingboingboing.net. And, of course, he's in New York touring with his new book. It's exciting.
Pirates.
And his T-shirt, because we can't see the whole thing, says, "I read banned comics."
From the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, the ACLU of comics.
Amazing that such a thing even needs to exist in this day and age.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well. And from CBS Radio, Mr. Larry Magid. Our show today brought to you by our friends at Citrix, the makers of a great program. If you have to do meetings, meeting is believing with GoToMeeting. For a long time, GoToMeeting, I've talked about it as the best screen sharing app out there, Mac or PC. But now they've added a new feature that makes it really more like a real meeting. Not only are you seeing their screen, but you're meeting face-to-face with your team anywhere in the world with the new HD Faces. I have to say this, the quality of the video on the HD Faces is spectacular. And you can, of course, start a meeting on a Mac or a PC, but you can attend a meeting on a Mac, a PC, an iPad, an iPhone, an Android tablet. In fact, if you're using an iPad, you can actually use the camera, the headphones, the microphone on the iPad and be at a meeting anywhere, in the backyard, at a coffee shop, at a hotel, at an airport. Just really works well. Fast, easy to schedule a meeting, easy to join a meeting, which is important because, after all, if you're meeting with a client, you're doing a sales pitch, you don't want to make it hard for them to meet with them. You want to make it fun, engaging, interesting. And I have to say, if you are in sales, the ability of to see your client, for your client to see you, to kind of build that rapport with the video is very important. It really makes a big difference. I want you to try it free for 30 days. You be the judge. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button on the website, and use the promo code TWIT. Easy enough. 30 days free. If you decide you like it, after a month, $49 a month, flat fee for as many meetings as you want, as long as you want. It includes free teleconferencing for Conference Bridge and everything. It's just great. GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the offer code TWIT. Start meeting today. Meeting is believing with GoToMeeting.
You have something else to do with GoToMeeting.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. We're giving away an iPad.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you, Chad Johnson, producer. Now you've earned your keep today.
Thank you.
We're giving away, GoToMeeting's giving away an iPad. That's to kind of remind you, you can use an iPad for GoToMeeting. So we want you to share your story. Tell us where in the world you would meet, and with whom you would meet, and why you would meet with somebody. Do this on Twitter, though, so you don't make it a long story. You know, just like, I would meet with Corey to talk about Little Brother in London, and then you could use the hashtag TwitFreeiPad. That's important so that we could see all the entries. We'll pick at random from those entries for next week. So we're extending it another week, giving you one more week to perform. This contest is for legal U.S. residents only, I'm sorry to say. The lawyers made us do it. Rules and regulations are online at inside.twit.tv. So again, who you'd like to meet with, where in the world, why, use the hashtag TwitFreeiPad. That's very important you put that on there so we can find all the entries. That's how we're going to collate them all. Then we'll pick at random from an entry to award you an iPad. And we're going to autograph it, put stuff on it. This is going to be a nice iPad. Winner of the contest will be announced on or about, that lawyer must have written that, on or about October 21st, 2012. That means it could be any time. On or about. I think it'll be on this show on October 21st, 2012 is what I think. TwitFree iPad's the hashtag, but I've been wrong before. Mike says, I don't want my iPad autographed. If you don't want it autographed, no problem. Just tell us and we won't. Or we could write to eBay buyer if you prefer and just sign it that way. Gazelle owner. Windows 8 kicks off with its first official television commercial. My first reaction is it looks just like one of them Apple ads. Here you go. This is the first ad.
10, 9.
Good music.
8.
They blow up a laptop. They hit a pinata. They're playing tic-tac-toe. There's the Metro interface. Xbox video, they're watching. They're playing Fruit Ninja on a giant screen. And there's cinnamon buns. And then the rocket gets launched. A girl draws on the tablet, which is on an easel, and somehow she gets a printed picture. And now, what made that possible? Windows 8. That is an iPad ad. In fact, I bet you if you showed that to 20 consumers without warning them ahead of time, and you took that Windows 8 out at the end, they'd say, oh, yeah, that's the iPad ad. Right?
I, it's pretty uncanny, right? I mean, everything they do is copycat, right? I won't say that. You know, the interface itself, I'll give them that. That's unique. That's unique. But their go-to-market strategy, as we call it in business, right? I mean, their stores look just like the Apple stores. Their commercials look just they don't have a whole lot of originality, and I don't think they really try to. You know, the whole reason they're getting into devices is because Apple is now making, you know, the iPhone is worth more than all of Microsoft, generates more revenue than all of Microsoft. The iPad now generates more revenue than the whole Windows division at Microsoft. So, you know, they're following, they're not leading, and they'll probably do okay at it. I don't think they'll do as well as they did in the past when they've done this, but, you know, they'll remain big enough to be sort of top five tech company.
That's also a very big story. Microsoft, Steve Ballmer basically saying, hey, we're reinventing the business. He said this in a shareholder letter. Interestingly, and Paul Theroux pointed this out to me, for the last couple of months, if you went to Microsoft.com and you looked at the title of the window, it would say Microsoft homepage, devices and services. This is the new mantra at Microsoft. Steve Ballmer, in a letter to shareholders, which is shared with everybody else, including the press and the stores and retailers and OEMs, said basically, we're changing the business. Last year in this letter, he wrote, I said that over time, the full value of our software will be seen and felt in how people use devices and services at work and in their personal lives. This is a significant shift, both in what we at Microsoft do and how we see ourselves as a devices and services company. It impacts how we run the company, develop new experiences, how we take products to market. What is Microsoft saying, Jason, when they say we're a devices and services company?
Well, I mean, again, they're a market follower, not a market leader, right? And the whole world has moved in that direction, you know, in terms of the integration, right? In vertical integration of hardware and software, they're behind in that game. You know, Apple is killing it there, and so they're going, hey, you know, this is what we're going to have to do. And
Paul Theroux says we want to be more like Apple. Is that what they're saying?
I mean, I think a short translation of that might be, we're about to hose all of our OEMs, and you're going to have to pay us every month to go on using Windows.
I think you hit the nail on the head. Yeah. I mean, if you are Lenovo or Dell or HP, you're going, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Did I just see that you have 45,000 unread emails in your inbox?
Yeah. You didn't send me an email in the last year and a half, did you, Corey?
You're like inbox 1 million.
I'm trying to see how fast I get to 1 million. That's right. Is this how many unread tweets? Because that's good too.
Nice.
Wow. How's the Aegean stable looking there,
Herc? I don't even, you know, it's so funny because I often will just like open email and then close it right away. I'll take one look and I'll go, no. Maybe I should declare what do they call it? Email holiday
or
whatever?
Bankruptcy.
Make it a year. Yeah.
Yep.
2013 totally. Can be your email holiday.
No, I'll tell you why I don't, because then that would imply in some way that I was going to read the new email that came in after that. I'm not.
Yeah. Don't do that.
No, I wouldn't
every
want to
every day
do
is
that.
A holiday. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, how do you keep up? How do you keep up, Corey Doctorow, with email?
I'm inbox zero, man. So I've got a bunch of filters.
I hate people like you.
They point all of the so my like tip top rule is every time you reply to someone, have your mailer add them to your address book. Anytime something from someone in your address book comes in, drop that in a proper inbox and put everything else in a different inbox.
Oh, but wait a
minute.
That's a
big one.
That's not inbox zero. That's just filters. And then you have folders that are full of mail, but your inbox is
zero. No, because it means that you pay really close attention to your inbox, and then your holding pen of stuff, you know, that you're unlikely to look at. I usually just sort that by subject once a day.
Wow.
So that way anything that gets through the spam filter, you can just shift select like a whole block because it'll all have the same subject, nuke that. And what's left, you know, you go through really quickly. My mailing list rule is to, if there's a mailing list that I need to be on, is I drop that into another folder unless my name is mentioned in the body of the email. and then it goes into my inbox.
You need to write that into a piece of software, Corey. You need to write just call it Corey's inbox or something, right?
And yeah, it's like two lines in Thunderbird. Yeah, no, yeah, seriously, sell it as software as a service. There you go.
Back to software as a service. So devices and services. Now, Microsoft, apparently, because we just talked about this on Windows Weekly, considers a computer a device. I'm not sure I'd agree with them, but in this definition of devices and services.
Well, it's not a person.
Well, it's a machine, but a device implies mobile or Xbox. Okay. It's a device. I don't know.
How about a laptop? How about a laptop?
It's a machine. Laptop's not a device.
Ultrabook?
No, but I'm wrong, obviously.
I think device has become a generic term for any piece of hardware, and it's a way of including tablets, phones, computers.
Well, then what they're saying is meaningless because they're defining devices as hardware, and services, I bet you, they're defining as software. So they're saying we're in the hardware and software business. Well, so what?
Well, but doesn't services also imply that you're renting or you're somehow providing it via the cloud versus, in a box or at a disk or even downloaded, that there's something kind of dynamic and ongoing about this versus buying a copy of Windows or buying a copy of Microsoft Office and using it for 2 or 3 years, which is sort of the traditional model that Microsoft has exploited for the last, 30 years now?
It's software as a service.
They took too long to realize they're toast, right? Software's moving to the cloud, OS is moving to hardware, essentially being bundled in the hardware. It doesn't matter. It's it's so far into the background that they realized what are we left with? Microsoft Office, trying to peddle that on as many different devices as we can. Not a great business model. So that's what devices and services is about. It's realized the world's changed. We're not going to call ourselves a software company anymore. We're going to call ourselves a devices and services company.
Not to beat a dead horse, but Corey, do you consider your Linux computer on that Lenovo X22 as a device?
Yeah, sure. No, I was just going to say, you're right that saying we're in the devices and services business is like saying we're in the hardware and software business. But, this points out that we live in a world that's now made of computers. I mean, as your awesome DJ reads for your old Ford ads reminded me any number of times, a computer is a car is a computer. You
car
put
is
your body
a platform.
In.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so is a 747. You know, 747 is a flying Solaris box in an exotic case with a bunch of badly secured SCADA controllers.
I love it.
They don't use SCADA controllers in 747s, do they?
That's what the Boeing engineers tell me.
Oh, that's depressing. That's the controller that was used also on the centrifuges in the Iranian nuclear plants that were hacked with Stuxnet.
Yeah, it's the computer scienceization of the world. Everything is made out of the same primitives, both in hardware and software.
Right, and that's not a bad thing.
No, although, it's the problem is, and I've given a couple of talks about this, that we don't really have a model for a computer that can run all the programs except for the one that might get you into trouble or pisses someone off or breaks someone's business model. And yet, the more computers we have, the more problems there are that arise that have a computer somewhere in them, and the more people there are saying, can't you just build me, a phone that runs all the programs except for the one that interferes with my SMS revenue stream, or can't you just build me a 3D printer that can't print a solid state meth lab or an AR-15, or can't you just print me a self-driving car, make me a self-driving car that can run all the programs except for the drag racing program? And the closest approximation we have is not the appliance that only runs one program. Actually, appliances run all the programs and have spyware on them that kind of swims up out of their depths and says, I can't let you do that, Dave, when you try to run the program that the manufacturer didn't expect you to run.
How is that going? Are they succeeding with that?
Well, look at UEFI on ARM, right? I mean, there's platforms where now, if you're not signed, you can't run. And so you're essentially having to delegate all of your trust to the vendor with no ability to override the vendor's decisions. That's pretty intense. I mean, I kind of feel like our destiny, as members of the Walkman generation, the iPod generation, is we're all going to end up with hearing aids. And I really feel like it's important when I put a computer in my body that can omit certain things that I hear or transmit things that I hear to other people, that computer be designed such that I can see what it's doing. It's not designed to hide any secrets from me the way that you'd have to if you wanted to lock it to a single platform. And that I can choose who I delegate my trust to. I'm not pretending that I'm going to audit all that code, But if someone comes out and says, hey, it looks like there's something bad or wrongly implemented or vulnerable or deliberately messed up about this, I want to be able to change vendors.
Of course, this is all happening because of fear, as usual. Fear is a great motivator. Fear over privacy concerns, fear over security concerns end up putting, you know, yeah, we have security except from the people who design the stuff.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, I think that we've seen in the last couple of years a growing market for lawful interception devices where, you know, the CALEA standard that says that in the U.S. all switches have to have backdoors for law enforcement has meant that all over the world, anyone who wants to sell a switch in the U.S. makes it so that it's got a backdoor for law enforcement. That backdoor is frequently compromised by other entities, sometimes state actors and sometimes crooks. And then you know, that gets good to law enforcement. The wiretappers ball in D.C. every year features more and more ways that state actors and police agencies can interfere with your devices to wiretap you. And it kind of culminated last year when Jacob Applebaum went to the wiretappers ball and outed a vendor that was selling a network appliance you put in the data center for your national carrier. And then you gave it the email address of someone in your country who's using iTunes, and it waited for them to try and phone home to Apple to get an iTunes update. And then it shipped them a malware bundle lets you remotely operate the camera, the microphone, any kind of location sensors, read the hard drive, the screen, the keyboard, and so on. So, you know, when you've got state actors actually creating markets for 0 days instead of creating incentives for people who find vulnerabilities to disclose them so they can be patched, now there's a market to sell those vulnerabilities to governments and also to introduce those vulnerabilities so you've got something to sell, because obviously those things are worth a lot of money. Companies like Vupin in France are making big coin, you know, selling to spooks.
That was kind of the story at Black Hat and DEF CON this year was
sure
how many people were buying exploits at governments.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a huge risk. I think we create this horrible, perverse incentive to make computers less secure, even as we start putting computers in our bodies and our bodies into computers. I mean, it's a kind of a perfect storm of horrible dystopian technology.
In August, you wrote an article for Boing Boing the Comet. Well, actually, it was a speech you gave, I should say.
Yeah,
at the Long Now Foundation in July, but it's in Boing Boing, The Coming Civil War Over General Purpose Computing.
Yeah, and I gave that speech at DEF CON and at Google and at Long Now this summer. It was the follow-up to a talk I gave at Chaos Computer Congress called The Coming War Over General Purpose Computing. The two of them kind of go together as a kind of both a warning and a manifesto about how our devices should be designed.
Corey, could you just sum up like the top like two or three bullet points of your, you know, thesis?
Yeah, basically that since we don't know how to design devices that can only run the programs that don't upset people, and because lawmakers increasingly are seeing computers as the place where they can insert control, we've got this ongoing motif in our fights where people are saying, you need to accept that your computer won't run the software you choose, that we're going to be able to keep secrets from you so that we can lock your platform so that it will only run the programs that are approved. And that when you do that, you create these vulnerabilities in the computers that let bad guys do really bad things to them, whether those bad guys are, you know, the Iranian government, if you live in Iran, or, the rent-to-own companies, you know, like the rent-to-own companies that just settled with the FTC because they had low-jacked the laptops they were renting people.
You're kidding.
Oh, yeah, seven rent-to-own companies and a software company in Pennsylvania just settled with the FTC because they low-jacked their rental laptops, and they were secretly recording the renters of these laptops having sex, and they were recording their children, and they were intercepting their medical records, their communications with their lawyers, and their banking records. And the FTC said to them, as you'd imagine, you know, they said, you must stop doing this. You're not allowed to do this anymore unless you put it in the fine print. You didn't inform people that you were planning on doing it.
Then it's okay.
Put it in the fine print from now on, and then it'll be okay.
Wow.
So this is where.
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead, Leah. No, I was just saying, this is actually, I really do feel like over the next decade, probably decades, you know, one of the primary tensions in the digital world, right, is what we on the one hand we need, as Corey was mentioning earlier, this sort of greater regulation around the internet. We need to realize that the internet is in many ways a lifeline and will continue to be, and will be even in a greater, to a greater extent, for, you know, economic well-being, for, you know, healthcare, for lots of different things. And so we need a certain level of regulation and government involvement to make sure the playing field remains level, make sure that costs stay down and all of that. But on the other hand, you know, too much government involvement in the internet, you know, leads to trouble as well, to where, you know, a single point of failure, as well as, you know, government takeover and all of that, to the point that, you know, you need sort of the commercial free enterprise system to provide redundancy and choices and these types of things in order to keep it more free and more able to not be, you know, taken over by a government or governments and shut down, right? So that's one of the key tensions that we've got to figure out.
The problem is that it's not so much that whether government gets involved, it's that government has a way of getting involved in ways that are just not smart. I mean, going back in this country, the Communications Decency Act, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, the Delete Online Predators Act, there's act after act after act that are purportedly to protect people. They all have very high-minded goals. They all get overwhelming support, at least initially, from Congress. And then when you look at them carefully, when you actually sort of dissect them, you find that they have huge flaws in them. And it strikes me we have two parties when it comes to technology. We have the clued-in party, and we have the much larger clueless party, and the Republicans and Democrats in both of them. And you know, as somebody who spends a lot of time in Washington, mostly on the internet safety side, I see an enormous amount of lack of understanding, not only about how the internet works, but how it should work, and how does government interrelate with companies and with the larger community that's using this technology, and total cluelessness when it comes to the fact that this is an international media. You cannot control it from any given country, whether you're Iran or, for that matter, the United States.
Yeah, and I do think some of that cluelessness is going to age out, right? I mean, over the next decade, some of these people, I believe, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic, right? But some of that is going to age out. The people who understand, because they've been users of this from the earliest points they can remember, right, will be clued in to a degree, not you know, to the full degree, maybe, as, you know, all of us, because we live and breathe it every day, but. You know, I do think some of that's going to age out. Some of it's going to, and not all of it's an age thing. More of it's an experience thing, right? So, but the thing is we have this this issue that I think is also at the fundamental part of this, which is the economics of the digital age, and that's a lot of the sort of free enterprise versus government control of the web.
Mm-hmm. And it gets into this whole tracking issue, by the way. Big story this week, Leo. I don't know if you have this on the agenda or not, but the whole thing with the Apple's way of turning off iPad ad tracking in iOS 6, which, if you happen to know a lot about the way the phone operates, you might be able to figure out. But if you're just a normal person, it would be impossible. I had to write an article called "The Not So Intuitive Way to Turn Off iPhone Ad Tracking," and I had to kind of...
That's ironic, because wasn't Google trying to get around the fact that Apple had disabled ad tracking in Safari?
In Safari. This is on iOS 6. And, you know, if you go to your iPhone and you go to the privacy area, you're not going to find ad tracking. You're going to have to go to General and then About. And
are
it
you
just
talking third-party cookies? Is that the...
I'm talking about this thing. I'm reading my own piece here. This thing that took the place of the UDID. It's another kind of Apple... ad tracking, so-called non-permanent, non-personal device identifier, I'm quoting now, that advertising networks will use to give you more control over advertising's ability to use tracking methods. In other words, by default, iOS 6 is trackable. The apps you use, the websites you go to, it is by default trackable. You can turn it off if you have an engineering degree from MIT.
I'm going to say, because I'm looking in the privacy settings, and I don't see anything there.
Yep, go to Larry's World and scroll down for, you know, a not-so-intuitive way to turn off iPhone ad tracking. It's not that complicated, but you would never figure it out just by going to the obvious places.
So you need to go to Preferences, Larry's World.
you need to send me a check for $75.
It's not under privacy. It's in General About. I'm gonna do it right now, because that's...
Exactly.
But, the, you know, well, oh God, we could just get into so many
and
conversations.
Go all the way to the bottom, Leo.
By the way, if you're one of those people who listens to Twit at 1.5 or 2x speed, you might want to go to half speed now because you're not going to be able to follow any of this. So let me see. Okay, I'm going to a general. Okay.
Right.
And then I'm going to click on About. Oh, yeah. And sure, it's in the About section. That would make sense.
All the way down.
And at the very bottom,
there you go. You got
advertising. Limit ad tracking. There it is.
There it is. Yep.
Now, is that a do not track cookie? What is that?
Well, it's a limit ad, not a do not. Limit.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Only track us a little bit?
And is it only with Apple's own iAds, or is it with other services? It's not very...
Well, again, I'm quoting from Apple. A non-permanent, non-personal device identifier that advertising networks will use.
So a cookie, in effect.
In effect.
If you know, if they had any kind of style, that dialogue box would be called Beware of the Leopard.
You want to explain what that means?
Oh, it's from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy when he discovers his place is about to be knocked down. And he said, and the man from the town comes by and says, well, you know, the plans have been on display for quite some time. And he says, well, I went to see them. They were in a third sub-basement behind a locked door that said, Beware of the Leopard. And he said, yes, that's the display room.
Yeah. By the way, we just got a tweet that from Benjamin Mayo. Says the new iOS 6 limit ad tracking is better than the implementation in iOS 5. So there we go.
So there you go, folks.
Even better.
Yeah. And you thought it wasn't better.
Yeah.
We're going to take a break. I need a breather before all that. By the way, Microsoft is going to, if you like that ad, Microsoft is going to spend $1.5 billion on more ads for Windows 8. $1.5 to $1.8 billion, according to Forbes.
But the media needs the money.
The largest product launch in the history of the industry. Wow.
Will it start after the presidential ads go off the air?
That would be nice. Then we could just, we'll keep the media alive another year.
Maybe they could do attack ads on Apple and Android.
Oh, my. We're brought to you today. I'm going to do an ad. It's not a Microsoft ad. I'll do an ad. We're brought to you today by Carbonite.com. Backup done right. What if I were going to design backup, the ideal backup scenario, what I would do is I'd make it automatic. So you don't have to remember because I'm not going to remember. And even if, it's Sunday, it's time to back. No, that's not going to work. It should be continuous because you create new content all the time. You write a paragraph in your great American novel, or in Corey's case, the great British novel, and your hard drive crashes, you lost that paragraph unless it's continually backing up. That's the idea. It also doesn't just back up locally. It backs it up to the cloud. So if there's a real disaster, a fire, a flood, or somebody steals your stuff or you leave your laptop on the conveyor belt at the airport and it's gone, poof, you got it backed up. You got it backed up on Carbonite, the better backup plan, secure, automatic, online backup, $59 a year for everything on a computer. That's less than $5 a month. Now, they do have plans for business, flat rates for multiple computers, external drives, and so forth. But the basic plan, great for a laptop or an individual, $59 a year. I want you to try it free for 2 weeks. It does use your internet access. It doesn't slow you down or the internet, but you should try it to make sure you're comfortable with it. Just go to Carbonite.com. Use our offer code TWIT. Now, do use that on the trial, even though you don't need to or need a credit card or anything, because if you do decide to buy 2 weeks down the line, you'll get 14 months for the price of 12, 2 months free from Carbonite. Carbonite online backup. It's also cloud storage. You can access your data anytime from any computer using your Carbonite account or their free smartphone or tablet apps. Really is a nice way to kind of give yourself a peace of mind. Carbonite.com. Oh, and in terms of privacy, it's using 128-bit SSL, of course, so that you don't have to worry about using it at an open access spot or anywhere you're online. But you also can use Trust No One, local encryption. Only you have the key if you choose as well. Carbonite.com. Use our offer code TWIT. Thank you, Larry. This was useful. I have now turned that off, although I don't know what I turned off or whether... it makes any difference. And frankly, there probably is a similar setting in Android, or maybe not. I don't even know.
Leah, so did I ever tell you how I back up my novels?
How do you? Because, I have a friend, Amy Tan, novelist, who's living in the Oakland Hills during that fire, lost a novel. Like, it burned.
Wow.
Her backup burned. So what do you do? Because that would be horrible.
Oh, yeah, I know. That would suck. And I travel a lot. So, I archive my papers with a library in Toronto called the Merrill Collection, which is the largest public science fiction reference collection in the world. And one day the head librarian said to me, you know, it's such a pity, because in the old days when we archive manuscripts, we get like a first draft, a second draft, a third draft, and they'd be distinct and we could study them and see the differences. Now it's just like a continuous document that's edited until it's submitted and done. If only there was a way to keep track of changes to text.
Oh, no, you're not using Git.
Yeah. So... My friend Thomas Gideon from the Command Line podcast wrote me a set of Git scripts that are on GitHub. It's called Flashbake. And every 15 minutes or however long you run, however often you run the cron, it grabs all my working files. It grabs the difference. And then it commits them along with it figures out where I am from the IP address, gets the weather, the last three headlines I put on Boing Boing, the last three songs I've played in my player. So it's kind of I have a like on a paragraph by paragraph basis, all of this. And then I can mirror that up to another Git server. So I've got it locally and I've got it mirrored up every couple of 10 minutes. So it's super secure and kind of right up to the minute.
Nice.
And I love it that it backs up what you're playing too.
Does that mean when they study you 1,000 years from now, there's going to be all these electronic manuscripts, kind of like, you know, when you look at the works of Shakespeare and get to see what he scratched out, we'll have that for Dr. O too.
Yeah, I'm kind of thinking, you know, like... apart from the risk of what happens if the database is compromised, you know, really you could capture it on a keystroke by keystroke basis. Yeah. And you could also grab a picture. You could grab, you know, skin galvanometry from the touchpad. You could probably estimate pulse from the camera because a good camera can now estimate pulse if it can see your neck and so on. So you could get a whole lot of biometrics and you could kind of go like, you know, sort of endocrinologically, how does my endocrine system relate to my prose output? And
the Twinkie defense,
cool.
Right? I ate Twinkies
That's right.
Yeah. But then the key is to, you know, you've got all this data. What do you do with it? And I guess that's where we're kind of getting better at big data and analyzing it. And
I think, you know, in 10 years, I turn it over. I mean, I had a weird.
Yeah, but who's going to want it? Well, you're famous. People will want it.
Some scholar might, right?
But yeah. Scholar might. But most people, who wants it? I mean, I think of Gordon Bell, who, you know, he had the cameras wearing it around. So who's going to want that? My kids don't even want the photo album I took of them when they were babies.
I mean. Charlie Strauss says it's the beginning of history, that it's the first time that we'll know about the minutiae of the lives of everyday people.
Right.
I had a weird thing last summer that I think is kind of a harbinger of a bunch of stuff that's going to happen, which is an old friend of mine who is a coder who I'd known since we were both coders when we were young teenagers, died unexpectedly in his sleep with his computer on in his room.
Oh, dear.
And his parents didn't know what to do. And, you know, he didn't live with his parents, but his roommates didn't know what to do. His parents didn't know what to do. And I said, look, let me just back this up and put it somewhere for you until you figure out what to do with it. So I went and grabbed a terabyte of data off of his hard drives, which I've stuck in S3 and prepaid 10 years for, and in a big password-protected zip archive that they have the password to. And I figure in 10 years, they'll figure out what to do with it. This is his whole life, right? And it's stuff that's compromising, that should never see the light of day, and it's stuff that should never, ever be thrown away, that's, you know, precious and irreplaceable, his, you know, some of his correspondence, his photos, his writing, his code. And I think we, as a society, have totally not figured this out. And
no
we're,
kidding.
We're about to run up against this. I think there's a huge business there.
Do you plan for, I ask all of you guys, but I'll start with Corey, for your death and what happens? Have you planned that?
Yeah, you know, so a couple of years ago, a writer named Mike Ford, John M. Ford, died intestate. And his common law wife wasn't legally entitled to run his estate, and his estranged parents, who are very religious and didn't approve of his work, were. And they wanted to suppress his work. And a lot of his writer friends, particularly Neil Gaiman, rallied around and sort of threw argument and money and lots of other things at them until they agreed to let his work go on to be in print. And after that, Neil Gaiman went on a tear and made all of his writer friends create living wills or wills where they had literary estates. So I've nominated a literary executor as John Scalzi. And then I've taken my hard drive password, and I split that into two, and half of it's with a lawyer in the UK and half with a lawyer in the US. And there's instructions for what to do when you get them back to decrypt my hard drive, which has all my other passwords on it. And so I've actually gotten that far, but I haven't gotten as far as figuring out how to tell people what I want done with the data, apart from my writing, you know. And I've got logo programs I wrote on an Apple II Plus in 1979 on my hard drive, and everything since.
It's really challenging to think about. Jason, have you done any? I mean, Corey, you've done more than anybody I've ever heard of.
Yeah, same here. Same here. No, I mean, as soon as you have kids, you start to think about this kind of stuff a lot, right?
I mean, I've got a will and, you know, the trusts and all that stuff, but that's just material possessions. Really, in many ways, the product of your ideas, that's of your mind, that's more valuable. What happens to that?
It's true. You know, I've got stuff on my machines, you know, even like writing stuff that I want to publish eventually, you know, lots of half done things, projects. It's like, what happens to that stuff? Even, you know, journal stuff, electronic journaling and all of that. So yeah, I've been, my wife and I've talked a little bit about that. Like, what do we, you know, do, you know, leave the passwords and, obviously a lot of it's on drives right now, external drives. And so, you know, that stuff, other people can get at, right. If something happened. So, that's the extent to what I've done so far, but this is definitely a topic that I've thought a lot about because there's some stuff that it's kind of like, I'm a big history buff, and if you look at the past, you know, you look at even like founding fathers in the U.S., you have the two models. You have the Thomas Jefferson, George Washington model, and you have the John Adams model. John Adams saved every frickin' thing that he had, right? Organized it, codified it. When he died, you had everything. So now we go back, I mean, we see his shopping lists. We see, you know, all of his letters to his wife. They saved everything. Whereas you look at Jefferson and Washington, they torched about half their stuff. Right. And the other stuff that is kept is the stuff they wanted history to be able to look at. Probably the most interesting stuff is the stuff they got rid of. Right. And so, you know, we don't really know them to a certain degree. So, but it's like that for all of us individually to lesser degrees for our families, right? What's the stuff we want to keep that we want them to see? And what's the stuff that we don't? And, you know, even deciding between that stuff is there's some hypocrisy in that as well. But, yeah, it's just a really interesting question.
I want a dead man switch that just deletes everything.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny.
I don't want to save it. And I don't want anybody to have to go through it.
Just about everything that I have that I would want anyone to see has already been published. I'm not working on a book at the moment. So pretty much when I get an idea, I write about it, I publish it, it's in the ether. And I have other stuff that, frankly, I've password protected because I don't really necessarily want anybody to see it. And I wouldn't mind if that got shredded along with me at some point. But I think the big problem for everybody, whether you don't have to be a journalist or an author to have this problem, are all of the passwords to all of your accounts. I mean, your investment accounts, your bank accounts. What happens?
Yep. Your Facebook account, your Twitter account.
You have a significant other and you know, they don't know the passwords. And you should be changing your passwords frequently. And do I always update my wife every time I change
There's
my
a
bank
business
account
here.
Password? I don't.
There's a business here. You know, Brian Brushwood and Patrick Delahanty created Afterlife, right?
Yeah.
Have they done anything with this? Afterlife.me, L-Y-F-E?
I believe that it was the original service was to tweet you, like, it would keep
He's
the
dead
record.
Now.
Right. It would keep a record of your year, and once you died, it would retweet everything that you had done the past year. So your family, your friends would see you in a year forever. And then,
my stuff isn't that interesting now, let alone a year from now.
And but now it's like to preserve his passwords and stuff too, right?
I don't know if it's gotten that far yet, but that was the idea, was that it could really have that functionality.
If you wanted to start a fairly easy, kind of pretty human labor intensive, but not super high tech startup, you basically fan out, you know, business development guys in chinos and blue shirts to all the funeral homes in the country, and another set to all the major services, all the registrars, all the certificate authorities, all the major webmail providers and social networks. And you on the social network side, you say, look, we're going to certify that people are really dead and who is managing their estate. And when we do that, we want you to give us a set of login credentials. And then you go to all the funeral directors and you say, when someone comes in while you're selling them the aluminum casket they don't need, I want you to also sell them a service where we will certify that you are really the dead person's kind of person managing their affairs. And we will mediate with you to Google, Yahoo, Facebook, Twitter, none of whom will answer, have any kind of customer service department that will actually speak to an individual. And we'll get you the login credentials for your loved ones, everything, so that you can, you know, keep paying the bills or shut them down or put in an autoresponder or send out the funeral notice to everyone in their Facebook group or what have you in the event that you don't have that password. And then you just throw a bunch of stuff in where you say, oh, I promise that we're like super secure about this. We never, ever, ever, ever let anyone get all those logins without someone really being dead, even though it's, you know, a giant attractive nuisance. And everyone would believe you. And you could make a ton of money because those funeral directors are really good at selling stuff to grieving people.
But Corey, don't dead people have privacy rights? I mean, what about what are the privacy rights of people who are dead?
Well, you can't libel a dead person, which I find pretty interesting. I think dead people do have privacy rights, but I think that most of us who've died and haven't thought about it probably would like that some of that stuff would be preserved, right? Yeah. I mean, in the absence of any explicit wishes, I don't know what courts do.
Mark Twain did that with his biography. His autobiography got published 100 years later, right? Just recently.
But Franz Kafka, you know, he told Max Brod, burn all my papers when I'm dead. And Max Brod was like, yeah, I'll do that. You, don't worry, Franz. And then he died and he had them all published. And I always think, you know, if Franz really wanted them burned, he knew where the fireplace was, right?
Yeah.
You know, totally. That looks like a hesitation mark to me. You cut this way, not that way, man.
That's a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, if ever I heard. You burn them all.
The past, we're depressing the crap out of the chat room.
they're easily depressed. They've been depressed for 5 years. I for some reason I'm fascinated. Maybe it's because of my age, you know, and many of my friends are dead now. But it just seems like there's something that nobody. I mean, will is one thing. I mean, but even like, what happens to your Facebook account now if you pass? 25. I think there should be a way to create a site that's like your memorial site. Like,
yeah, Facebook actually does that. They actually have a way to memorialize your page, and your friends can make comments. And then there's the issues of what happens when people bully you after you die. And Facebook actually has it's true. They have there are it's really terribly tragic, but there are cases of teenagers who have been bullied and died or killed themselves, and then they continue to get bullied, and it's a big deal. It's a big problem, actually.
Facebook also
post-mortem bullying on the next twit.
Yep. Facebook also pushes ads with dead people's pictures in them. You know, your Uncle Bob's, Uncle Bob's feed.
That's not good.
Keeps showing up stuff that you know, with Uncle Bob retweeting or, you know, refeeding his love for Resident Evil 4 or whatever is getting sponsored pushes that week.
Well, I have that to look
forward to. And Uncle Bob also gets to vote several times, too, for another 20 or 30 years. in Chicago.
By 2050, Charlie Strauss told me that by 2050, half the people who've ever used the internet will be dead.
Wow. And then what?
Well, so the internet will be more dead than alive, right? The more the users of the internet will be dead than alive.
I plan to have an Ethernet cable, you know, in the grave, so I'll continue to use it.
You know, all of this is a product of the fact that over the past 15 to 20 years, right, all of this is changing and happening so fast. I mean, we can't barely keep up with the day-to-day changes of this stuff, let alone sort of the 20,000-foot view, the big picture changes of what does this mean for our lives and the ways that we're putting our thoughts and ideas and, you know, organizing our lives around all of this digital stuff. You know, this is stuff that's going to take a long time to figure out, and there's going to be some stuff that gets lost and mangled in the process, unfortunately.
We're going to take a break, but there's a big story just breaking, and we'll have it for you. SoftBank just bought Sprint.
Oh,
there were rumors that this was happening. Remember, Deutsche Telekom tried to sell T-Mobile to AT&T. That was turned back by regulators. And it made everybody wonder, well, what happens to Sprint? And of course, the great fear was if T-Mobile gets sold or merged with AT&T and then Sprint goes away, we'll have two carriers. It's bad enough with four carriers. Well, we'll have the details on that and your thoughts, too. I know that's a very U.S.-centric story, but something we're interested in just a second. But first, let's talk about, you know, I was just thinking maybe you could make a Squarespace site, prepay, you know, like 100 years. And then you would have the site that where your memorial. How long do you want it to last? Squarespace should start some sort of infinite deal, like forever, as long as we're around. But how long is any of us going to be like Squarespace? How long is Google going to be around? Is Google going to be around in 100 years? Facebook?
You'll be able to buy it on a thumb drive for a buck.
The world is changing so fast now, we don't even really know what it's going to look like 100 years from now. I'm pretty sure it's not going to look anything like we look like to 100 years ago.
I think Google will come in injection form in 100 years.
Yeah, who knows? The singularity is nigh. You wrote a book about the singularity, your last book.
Well, kind of an extended joke about the singularity, as well as a bit of a love note to it and a kind of sarcastic, doubting note. But maybe an intervention with the singularity. Me and Charlie Strauss.
That's what we need.
This book, Rapture of the Nerds.
We'll talk about that too. I do want to talk. It's a great book. I want to talk more about that. But first, let's do the ad. Squarespace.com. The secret behind exceptional websites. The new Squarespace is here. They're version 6 of their software, completely rewritten from the ground up, 50 new features. One of the key features is Squarespace. This was something that Squarespace really knew they had to do. Used to be, in days gone by, last year, when you made a site, you'd make it the desktop site and the mobile site. But now, more than half of your visitors to almost any site are mobile. Does it make sense to have a separate mobile site anymore? Squarespace says no. Squarespace and most modern web designers say one size fits all. What we're going to do is make a site using something called responsive design that will be appropriate no matter what size screen, whether you're using an iPhone or a Galaxy Note 2 or something even bigger, like a 27-inch iMac. So go to squarespace.com. Now, I got to tell you, I don't do this. I should be more clear about this. This is two things. Hosting, the best hosting ever. It never goes down. And software combined. And the advantage of doing that is the software is always up to date. You don't have to worry about patches, security flaws. They always keep it up to date. They really do have the best hosting. And I think it has something to do with the tight coupling between the content management system and the server software. We have tried and have failed time and time again to bring a Squarespace site down. You just can't do it. Beautiful templates. You're choosing from designer templates. You can customize as to your heart's content. And again, you don't have to worry about the responsive design because, for instance, when you put an image in there, it creates 7 different sizes so that it always looks great on any screen. Even when you change the column widths and so forth, all of that is automatically handled in the new templates for Squarespace 6 so that everything looks great on all the different sizes. You get, of course, the ability to use HTML5, CSS3, JavaScript, and JSON because it's state-of-the-art, but you don't have to even know what those terms mean to use a Squarespace site. They've got, by the way, a great syntax-colored editor that pops out if you're a big CSS or a JavaScript user. You can import from the existing, almost all the existing APIs so that your data goes right in, including all of the links, all the images, all the comments even. Export to, you're never trapped in a Squarespace site. And the ability to include things like Google Maps and Flickr and Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff with just little widgets means that your site will be a rich, vibrant place to visit. I think Squarespace is a great site, great place to host your site, whether it's a one-off for a wedding or an anniversary or a birthday or your e-commerce site. I want you to visit squarespace.com. And as with all of our sponsors, we really encourage this, and I think it's a testimony to how confident they are in their product. They offer you a free 2-week trial. You don't need to use a credit card or anything. You just go to squarespace.com, click the Get Started button. You could try it for 2 weeks. If you decide you like it or you want to keep that site, that's where we come in. They've got 2 plans now. They've really simplified this, the basic plan and the unlimited plan. Standard plan starts at $8 a month when purchased annually. You can also get it $10 month to month. But the unlimited plan is the one you should look at. $16 a month, $16 a month for hosting and software with unlimited pages, galleries, blogs, unlimited bandwidth. They're not metering the bandwidth at all. Unlimited storage, unlimited contributors. And when you buy an annual plan, they'll register the domain for you for free and they'll hook it up to your Squarespace site for free. All of that for $16 a month. And now here's the good stuff. When you put in the offer code TWIT10, you could take 10% off that. So if you get the annual plan, you get the biggest savings. Squarespace.com. Use the offer code TWIT10. You only need that when you buy. It's free to try. You'll save 10%. TWIT10. And if you're listening to this in November or December, it's the number. It's TWIT and then the number of the month. So TWIT11 will work next month, TWIT12 the month after, like that. And then we start all over again. Squarespace, the secret behind truly exceptional websites.
I've been using them for 2 years. I haven't moved to 6 yet, but I'm going to do it before the end of the year.
Well, it's a little tricky moving to 6 because you can't just take your template and move it over. Your content will move over, but you really want to start with a new template so that you get the responsive design.
Yeah, that's what I need to start with, the new template and do that and tweak it a little bit. But it's a great service. Every time I've had a problem or wanted to tweak something, their responsiveness has been terrific. And so, I have no problem recommending them. And The fact that you can bring any of your data in and you can get it out at any time is very customer centric. Like that a lot too.
Just about an hour ago, CNBC reported that SoftBank, the big Japanese cell company, I think they're not number one in Japan, I think number three in Japan, but they're a big company, has agreed to buy 70% of Sprint in the United States. That's a $20 billion purchase. The deal is expected to be announced tomorrow morning. The boards of both companies have agreed in principle. Of course, there'll be some regulatory hurdles that they have to jump. The current price per share of Sprint is $5.73. The tender is $7.30. So that's a good premium for Sprint shareholders. So given the structure, it says it will not require a shareholder vote.
It's not a fire sale. I mean, that's
good money.
Yeah. Right. It's not a fire sale, which is kind of surprising. Sprint really, they really failed. They really tripped over WiMAX. They could have done something so cool, and they set out to do something so cool, and they kind of ran out of money, and they also sort of ran out of they ran out of regulatory leverage to a certain degree, because they were trying to get WiMAX out. And the thing that they were doing with WiMAX was WiMAX was trying to unlock the sort of stranglehold that the carriers have over mobile broadband in many ways. But they at the same time they were doing that, they had to buy bandwidth. All these towers, you still have to buy backhaul to the towers, right? And they had to buy this stuff from a lot of their competitors, the ones who had the most to lose from what the way Sprint was going to roll out WiMAX. So ultimately it failed. They ran out of money, they ran out of time, and they had to sell. I don't know that SoftBank, Sprint now has essentially an ancient network. They have the CDMA network. They don't really have they do have a decent data network, but it's aging. It's kind of like, what do they really buy? Well, the main thing that Sprint has is a massive amount of the airwaves, right? Of the spectrum in the U.S. And so that's what I think SoftBank is really
interesting.
Buying. Is the spectrum and not the assets of Sprint itself, which are, of dubious value. The WiMAX has pretty much failed. It's sort of a declining asset. Sprint CDMA network, also a declining asset. But all of the spectrum that they own in the U.S. is more than most of the other carriers. I believe it's even more than Verizon if you go and you look at all of their spectrum assets. So it is still a viable asset, but you're talking about a longer-term build-out if they're going to shelve all the stuff that Sprint has already done and replace it with some kind of GSM LTE network based on SoftBank, which is certainly a possibility.
Sprint is already replacing its WiMAX 4G network. So Sprint was the first national carrier in the U.S. to have so-called 4G with WiMAX. I actually am a Sprint customer, and I largely have it because of the unlimited data. I really like not having to look at a meter every time I download data. But the problem is, living in the Bay Area where we don't have LTE, that data that I do get unlimited amounts of comes very slowly. So I'm still on 3G. But they are rolling out LTE nationally. They're taking their time. I think they're in about 20 markets right now.
They announced 100 new markets this week, including, and the reason I know that is because Petaluma, where we are, is one of them.
Are you actually online yet, or are they announced you're coming online?
Well, the press release was interesting. It didn't specify a date, and they said, but you may notice LTE soon, and you can use it. But the official launch is in the future. So I don't have a Sprint LTE Sprint phone. So
I'll have to turn mine back on, although I'm going to Argentina tomorrow where Sprint doesn't work. I have to carry a GSM phone when I'm down there. But up here, I have to turn on, because sometimes it'll work and sometimes it'll don't. But the point is that they're abandoning the WiMAX. They're moving over to LTE. So they're going to have the same type of network as AT&T and Verizon. And this is also interesting in light of the fact that T-Mobile is trying to acquire Metro PCS. So does that mean we're now going to have, four viable mobile phone companies? That would be a good thing.
That'd be fantastic.
If we do. Yeah.
Exactly the opposite would have looked like last year with the Deutsche.
Exactly.
I wonder if CDMA can actually be phased out and GSM phased in without any kind of regulatory hurdle from the FCC. It's funny because you see Sprint customers overseas in England. They're the ones looking at their phones going, why doesn't this work?
Does it work?
You know, My last trip home,
they're lucky because if it did work, they'd be paying $3 a minute to use their phone.
That's true. Well, no, but even with a local SIM, I mean, my last trip home, I got off the plane. I came back from my last tour. I got off the plane. I had a shower at the arrivals lounge, the BA lounge, and I ran into Bill Nye, the science guy. And I went up to him and I went, you're Bill Nye, the science guy. You're so awesome. And he said, are you American? And I said, I'm Canadian. He said, good enough. I've got a Sprint phone and it doesn't work. Where do I rent a phone? And I was like, I don't know where you rent a phone at Heathrow, but you know what? I've just come back from Burning Man, and I brought my old Nexus phone along as a camera. It's in my bag. I'll reset it to factory defaults. Here's my card. Mail it back to me when you're done. So Bill and I went around London with my phone.
Can you guys see this? This is my bucket of phones.
That's
some of them are GSM
bucket phones.
I'm going to go through this later tonight. I'm going to pick out a couple to bring with me to Argentina. hope that they
one
work.
Of them sure to work. And I just went to my phone bucket to pull out my Sprint, my only Sprint phone, which is a Galaxy S2. I'd be very curious. Maybe we are getting 4G. The problem is a lot of these carriers, including AT&T, label HSPA Plus and other phony things as 4G. Clearwire, which is the WiMAX that Sprint was using, was terrible. Huh. By the way, according to the CNBC report, Sprint's got 48% of Clearwire and needs to complete the purchase of Clearwire before this can go through. So it's expected that Sprint will soon announce the full acquisition of Clearwire. I don't know why they want it.
Why would they want it?
That's all spectrum. That's all spectrum.
It's spectrum. It's not the spectrum. It's not the technology. It's the frequencies.
No, it's the it's airspace, right? That's like beachfront property, right?
It's like when an airline buys another airline for the gates rather than the planes,
which is exactly
why they buy them. Yeah.
Excellent metaphor. You know, the spectrum, Sprint owned a bunch of this spectrum. They spun it off and they gave it to Clearwire essentially when they spun off their 4G as Clearwire. They're just buying it back, right? When they're buying Clearwire, they're just buying back all that spectrum because it's beachfront property.
Got it.
This is like a telecoms version of an acqui-hire.
Right. That makes sense. And now I don't know, I was owned by SoftBank, not me personally, but Ziff Davis was owned by SoftBank briefly. And I don't have great memories of it. But on the other hand, I don't have horrible memories of it either. Well, I'm booting this up. You know, it says 4G right here, so that must be.
They wouldn't let them put it on a phone if it wasn't true.
You know, none of this is actual 4G. That's the other thing. It's all a big fat lie.
LTE is closest, but it's still not. Yeah. You know what the original specifications of 4G were based on.
The ITU. I love this. It's in Wikipedia, so it's got to be true. 4G is nominally 100 megabits download. Oh, yeah. But the ITU made an exception in the U.S. They said, well, if it's a big improvement over your 3G network, you can call it 4G. So we don't have any of that. I don't know. Corey, who's your carrier in Great Britain?
I use Orange, and I'm not super thrilled with them, but they just, I'm grandfathered into a unlimited data plan they unwisely offered 10 years ago. And so I'm going to stick with that until they... I don't know, somehow decide to violate their contract or go bankrupt or something. But I mean, they're hilarious because Orange is a French company, but you go to France and they're like, yes, Orange France is not Orange UK. And they and you wouldn't believe the roaming rates Orange France charges us here at Orange UK.
Yeah.
Honestly, there's nothing we can do about it. I mean, it's, we're as shocked as you are that you're paying £8 a megabyte in France.
£8 a megabyte.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, if you're lucky.
I mean, my advice to anybody gets on a plane, turn off data before the plane takes off, because by the time it taxis to the terminal, you could be broke. I mean, it could be really devastating.
I went to Russia with like a 300 meg for the weekend plan, and I ran over it because their bit counter lagged by like just a couple of minutes. I ran over it by a couple of megs, and the bill was something like £78.
Oh man.
What's the best
in Soviet UK, Russia network runs over you?
Yeah, exactly.
What's the best UK temporary SIM part, in terms of mobile broadband?
I got no idea.
Three.
I think you go into his agent. Is it three?
I hear very good things about three. Sarah Lane, when she was in London for Le Web London, got a three SIM, put it in. It was very cheap. It included unlimited data. It was a great deal. I can't remember what it
and,
cost. But it
and
like
if anyone out there knows the best Argentina plan, please at Larry Maggot on Twitter. I can use that information early tomorrow morning.
This is big stuff, actually. I'm in London in 3 weeks. That's why I was asking. But it's big stuff.
This is tech support for all of us.
You know what the biggest story is? If you got the iPhone 5 from Verizon with the unlocked SIM card, you got the best international phone, and it's from Verizon.
Hey, but do those little tiny SIM cards, whatever they're called, exist
anywhere
besides
the US?
No, you have to
cut the SIM down.
Somebody's sending me a nano. Frazier's sending me a nano SIM cutter.
Is it like a little guillotine?
Well, the funny thing is it actually cuts some of the, you know, the contacts. Most of the SIM is paper, but this actually, the nano SIM cuts the contacts and apparently still works. So I guess those were extra.
Half those traces. They don't do anything. That's why I use brake fluid and windshield wiper fluid in the same bucket. It's all the same crap.
Chop it off.
They put dye in it just to mark you up. They screw you.
You didn't need that. Hey, as long as we're talking phones, the chat room's going to hate me. I got to talk about my Galaxy Note 2. I love it. Do you like big phones, Corey? Giant?
I got the Nexus. I got the big Galaxy.
That's a nice phone. Oh, yeah, you said that. That's a nice phone. Actually,
mine's
that's the same resolution as this, but this is 5.5 inches. I think this is the phone for old people like me because I can, and people with sausage fingers because I can type on it. I can see it. It's so big. Does this phone make my head look small?
You know, there's a British comedy sketch where a guy walks around with a phone that's like sort of the size of a baguette, and he's got a clutch to the side of his head, and he walks in, and it's like a kind of like ambush comedy, like he walks into places like banks, and he says, "I'm on the phone! I can't hear you! I'm on the phone!" And he's got this phone that's literally like as big as a toddler stuck to the side of his head. It's really amazing.
Yeah. Nice.
So
that's about what the Galaxy Note looks like. I mean, it's about
a baguette. It's pretty close.
But what happened to the trend? Remember a few years ago, they were trying to make phones as small as they could?
Right.
Like Palm came up with this teeny, teeny little
phone.
That
was so 90s. Yeah. That was in the 90s.
Right.
I once did a signing at a French science fiction convention next to this young French woman who'd published her first novel at 18. And I got a text and I took out, I had some big Nokia phone with like a Zeiss lens and it was giant. And I took it out to answer the text and she went, "Your phone, it is so big." And then she took out a phone like the size of her fingernail and pulled out the antenna and went, "Hello?"
I'm so proud of my little phone.
It was really funny.
I actually have the video of the giant phone. It's Dom Jolly, or Jolie, right?
That's the guy.
Yeah, he apparently...
The baguette phone?
You can watch this on the YouTube. He's on a train with his giant phone.
That looks like my first cell phone. I think I had one about that size.
I'm on a train! A car thing! Yeah, no, I can't talk too long. We're in a tunnel! In a tunnel! Hang on! Yeah, that's great!
I'm in a train!
It's funny the first time, but I think he's recorded about 140 hours of that in various contexts.
It goes, it works, it always works. You can do no wrong. Everybody hates cell phones.
That guy's going to send you a takedown notice tomorrow.
Oh, I guarantee you. You know, at this point, it's actually every week on Twit. And it's things like Brazilian TV, and sometimes it's like for a year-old episode. It's just weird. I get YouTube every day. I get a YouTube takedown notice.
Really?
You're lucky that they're not enforcing their Attract 3 complaints, get booted off of YouTube forever.
Let's talk about that. AT&T says 6 strikes and you're out. That's coming up in just a bit. But first, let's see what we missed this week on Twit.
This is Twit, Tech News Today.
I'm going to go out on a limb, Tom, and maybe I'm shooting myself in the foot here, but I'm going to say that it is no longer mythical.
Don't shoot yourself in the foot out on a limb. You'll fall.
Home theater geeks.
The tagline was perfect sound forever.
I remember well.
So, and I got to ask, if it was perfect sound, why did people not like it?
The tech guy.
Phones are like purses. You ever notice a woman never goes to a smaller purse? They only go to bigger purses and bigger and bigger. You escalate. And phones are like that. You start getting a big screen, then you can never go to a smaller screen. You got to go to bigger.
Gizwiz.
Hey, come here. Give me a hug, you crazy internet you. You just Just give me a big hug. Come on. Come to your daddy.
Twit, we love you.
Yeah, they would. They would. That would be the segment they use in the best of episode. Those are some of the things you missed this week on Twit. We do that because sometimes people watch this show and they don't know that there's actually other shows on the network. Some of them. Samsung did unveil a mini Galaxy S3 now. Speaking of bigger and smaller, there's a 4-inch Galaxy S3. So now they have a 4, 4.3, 4.8, and 5.5. This is basically a Galaxy S3 with a giant screen, the Galaxy Note.
Yeah, yeah.
Any size. But I think that that's their strategy, right? Is that it's basically the same phone across the board. But and Jelly Bean, which I have to say is a lot better Android operating system than... In fact, this, at this point, it's every bit as good as anything anybody, including Apple, has ever produced. And every bit as fast. It's very, very fast.
Notifications are amazing on that, by the way. I mean, that's kind of the killer. I still believe that's the killer feature that it has over that Android has over iPhone. And they took it even further with Jelly Bean is the notifications. They're just so
so beautiful,
you know, so amazing. Yeah.
I think at this point, and I love the Samsung ads where they basically they're saying, you know, the iPhone's for your mom and dad.
Yeah. That's funny. Very funny.
Mom, is this at the end of the ad? She says, "Is this? Am I in line for the apps?" Yes, Mom. You're in.
Is Apple going to sue Samsung for a 4-inch screen? Do they have a patent on that?
No, because this is such a weird shaped 4-inch screen. It's so weird.
Yeah,
it's tall. Yeah. Anyway, enough of that. So
can we talk about that outfit that you were wearing, Leo, in the clip that they had?
What outfit? Okay. What are you talking about?
Okay, just checking.
Okay, so that's the GizWiz, which is our gadget, you know, kind of goofy gadget review show. And I do a segment on it, crap I found on SkyMall. And and so what we do is we pick some stuff from SkyMall and we let the audience vote. And each week I buy whatever they said I should buy. In this case, it was a tie-dyed union suit. I threw in the hat. That's a pork pie hat.
That's vintage. That's vintage.
You know, it's remarkably comfortable.
And it's ready to wear at the playa.
I have now finally a playa costume. I'm ready for Burning Man.
By the way, you're looking pretty trim and fit in that costume there, Leo.
That's not what Dr. Mom. I have a physician in the chat room who diagnoses me via chat. She said, no, you've got to lose weight. what were we going to talk about? I forgot. Oh, AT&T, six strikes and you're out. Now, this is the three strikes law, the Hadoop law in France, I think has been overturned, right?
No, Hadoopy.
Hadoopy. Hadoop is Microsoft's.
No, Hadoopy hasn't been overturned, but the new government is talking about doing something with it. But it's they've sent out a heptillion notices threatening disconnection. The only person they've ever actually tried to enforce against was a guy who they admitted hadn't downloaded anything. His ex-wife had used his connection to download, and they're like, but under the law, you are responsible. So they fined him some euros, but they didn't disconnect him from the internet. But in America, AT&T just leaked a memo that Torrent Freak got that basically describes what their regime is going to be, and that's if you get unsubstantiated copyright complaints, after a couple of them, they take away your YouTube and your Facebook until you go to copyright re-education school, and then if you get six of them, they just disconnect you. And of course, AT&T has successfully lobbied in lots of places to prevent any kind of municipal Wi-Fi or anything that might compete with them. And, you know, it looks like Sprint's 4G is not going anywhere. So, you know, it's like Lily Tomlin. You know, what are you going to do without us? We're the phone company. You're going to use two tin cans and a string for your broadband? So, it's pretty bad. I mean, it's pretty depraved.
I've been complaining. I had some run-in with Comcast this week trying to get it installed. And they're just – the service is so screwed up. You know, but – and so I tweeted about it. And that, boy, I tell you, they pay – for some reason, you could talk about it like crazy – on the radio, on the TV, but you tweet about it. They get I've been getting calls from the Comcast executive. The worst is this morning, 8 a.m., Sunday morning, 8 a.m., they wake me up. And I'm thinking, this is not what I call customer service. This is not what I'm looking for. Go away.
Yeah.
These guys are out of control. They're monopolists. None of them understand customer service because they never had to.
The thing about AT&T is really what they're saying, because in that briefing to their own customers, it says, what if someone says they didn't download anything? What should I tell them? And the answer is, you're responsible for anything anyone does on your connection. So what they're really saying is, although that's not a principle in law or anything, right? There's no contributory liability for leaving your Wi-Fi open. But what they're saying is, if you live in the same house as someone who's got a router that is implicated in an unsubstantiated accusation of copyright infringement without the chance to examine the evidence against you or rebut it or face your accuser, you lose your internet access.
Which means that you could have a child or a roommate who does something and you could lose your job, you could lose your ability to go to school, because having internet access is not just for playing games. It's how I earn my livelihood. If they took away my internet access, they would be taking away my livelihood. And it's one thing to do it, you know, if I did something illegal, but it could be a roommate doing it.
Well, and it includes, you know, mistakes, right? They accused a laser printer at a university of downloading an Indiana Jones movie once. if you have a rare disease and your support network is online, if you're from a diaspora population, the way you stay in touch with your family is over Skype, there's a million ways in which losing the internet costs you.
Right. Now, I just want to point this out. This is from Torrent Freak, and it is we don't know of the provenance of this. They Torrent Freak says this is an AT&T training document. I don't know one way or the other if it is.
AT&T said they would embrace a regime of six strikes and you're disconnected this year. If this isn't the training document, then there's some other training document that it must be substantively similar about disconnection, because they've agreed that they will disconnect along with all the other major carriers.
Now, that's the issue, is disconnect. And my sense of the original proposal was it didn't involve disconnection, it involved re-education and...
No, it was graduated. They call it graduated response, where it starts with, a stiff letter, and then you have to go to re-education school, and then, I don't know, they come over and they punch your grandmother, and then,
But they did say that for six strikes, we will cut you off.
Yeah, we disconnect you.
I'm just not sure we'll ever see this in the real world. I mean, if AT&T were owned by Time Warner, right? If this was Time Warner, I would... totally buy it, right? Because they are incented, because they're also in the content business.
They're in the content. But everybody's in the content business now. Comcast owns NBC Universal.
Yeah, but AT&T is not. AT&T makes all of their money by selling you, more broadband than you need and overcharging you for as much as they can. And they're in the business of keeping customers. And so I don't know. Like I said, I don't think this would hold up in court. I think AT&T is economically incented to keep you as a customer.
What court case would someone bring? I mean, I'm sure your contract says
Comcast, then there, yeah. Obviously, if it was one of those two companies, I'd be.
Jason, you're breaking up. I think Time Warner has something to say about this.
Yeah, right.
I just don't know what court case anyone would bring. I mean, it's just a contract thing, right? This is what your contract says. It's your terms of use. The problem is that if everybody else is doing it, AT&T is going to look at that and they're going to say, lawmakers, if we're the only ones who defect from this, lawmakers are going to come and clobber us.
Right.
Well, I don't know whether internet carriers are considered common carriers, but we do have protections when it comes
to
common carriers.
They're not.
They're not. Well,
absolutely not.
So it's just like any other contractual. You don't have any rights to communications to access.
No.
That's well, true.
I'm just saying they're economically incented to keep you as a customer, right? There's no AT&T isn't out there looking at big bandwidth hogs, right? Bandwidth hogs, they want to kick off the network. I could see them saying using downloading a bunch of stuff that's pirated and using that as a reason to say let's get them work because they're using up a bunch of our bandwidth. I just can't see them incented in any way because of copyright infringement to try to kick you off.
Is this a good time? And we're approaching an election in the United States. We're not only electing a president, but we're also electing members of Congress in many cases. Is this a good time to have a litmus test to say, to call your member of Congress up for election or his or her opponent and say, what is your stance on a free and open internet?
Sure. I mean, this is Fight for the Future. The folks who really spearheaded the anti-SOPA stuff, they're running Get Out the Vote campaign that involves contacting your lawmaker and talking to them about how you feel, or contacting the candidates and telling them how you feel about these issues. And I think, you know, in the wake of SOPA, there's some residual terror there in the halls of power that there is some kind of sleeping giant that at least rolled over in its sleep, if not actually waking up last year, and that more might happen. I mean, it was pretty seismic last year. You know, I was in D.C. a week before the SOPA hearing started. Every Hill rat, every, you know, congressional aide I talked to was like, just give it up. They've got the signatures. It's done. You lost. Forget about it.
Yeah. Didn't hurt that Google was on board, though.
Every couple of years, we get a chance to really let them know. And I think this is a very good time for everybody who watches this show, who's a geek, to write your, as Corey calls them, your Congress critter. And let them know, and especially if they're up for election, you might ask them that question. How do you feel about the six strikes?
All House members are up for election. They serve for
That's
2 years.
So all members of all the House members and many senators.
Yeah, a third of the senators.
Yep.
This is an opportunity to do that right now. You're not going to get this opportunity for another 2 years. Let's take advantage of it.
You know, there's more artists every year who are just showing that they don't need this kind of thing to thrive. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Humble Bundle that we launched last week, where we
launched. You can't miss it if you go to craphound.com.
Yeah, there you go. It's sitting right there. But I mean,
what is the Humble Bundle?
So it's like the Humble Indie Bundles for games, the same people who run it. I just volunteer for them. But, you know, they would gang up six games or eight games and say, name your price, give some of it to charity. We'll give you all these games. And the first one did over $1 million. The most recent one did 4.7 million in the first week. It's a little 2-week promotion. So we're doing this with a bunch of books. We got Neil Gaiman, John Scalzi, Paolo Bacigalupi, Mercedes Lackey, Kelly Link, my new novel, Lauren Bukes. And you name your price. We've done over $500,000 in like 4 or 5 days. You name your own price, and some of it goes to charity. You get to decide how much. The charities are EFF, Child's Play, which gives games and toys to children's hospitals, and the Science Fiction Writers America Emergency Medical Fund, which basically bails out writers who are going to lose everything because they got sick because they're freelancers. You know, it's a good cause. You get books. There's no DRM. It's going good.
You get e-books?
E-books, yeah. So we don't need six strikes. We don't need three strikes. We don't need surveillance. We don't need DRM. You know, we treat our customers like we'd like to be treated, and they come and give us $500,000. It's not bad.
Look at this. You could choose the amount. I love this website. So you choose the amount. You could do a custom amount or anything for $15 to $100. And then there's a slider that says how much goes to authors, how much goes to charity, how much goes as a humble tip to humble bundle.
If you tip those arrows, you can choose how much per author, too. So tip the little arrow next to the author.
Oh, so you could vote for – we should do this for Twit, because people keep saying, how do we donate to individual shows? So Cory Doctorow all the way – zero to everybody else.
No,
I think,
you know, it's
let's make
it's,
it a larger.
It just shows that you can be nice and people will do it. I mean, our top donor right now gave us $1,000.
Wow, isn't that neat?
I think this is the wave of the future, actually. And I think that actually, Corey, I think the way that you did it with your books, when you know your DRM free version of your books, I'm surprised more authors haven't done it. Right? I mean, you even threw it out there. If I remember right, then correct me if I'm wrong, but you threw it out there for free, and even said if there are other formats, you guys, you know, submit your formats, and we'll add them to the list and of download. And it obviously didn't work as it didn't hurt your revenue. It actually helped spread the word about your product further and wider and get it in the hands of more people, created more fans, and then, you know, created more of a viable product and a viable brand for you. So, right.
And it's not like I can stop you from copying if you want. Yeah, that's exactly what I did. But it's not like I can stop you from copying if I want. Right. Like there's no magic way I can get the food coloring out of the swimming pool. Right. It's a book. It's like, you know, 80K. You know, you can copy it in a second. So the only thing I can do is convince you to pay for it, not coerce you.
Well, I just bought your book and $100 to Humble Bundle.
Good for you.
Yeah. Is this your preferred way to sell your book, Corey? Is this how you'd like to sell it?
One of the many preferred ways. I mean, it's all the same to me.
So I just did a story about Bookshare.org, which is a Palo Alto organization that provides free reading material to blind and physically disabled people who have trouble with regular books. And the biggest problem that they have is digital rights management, because Once you have a DRM-free book, you can make it big screen. You can make an audio version. You can actually make it useful to a person who has a physical disability. But with DRM, it's actually making their work harder. So ironically, even though they have a license to get free books, they're pushing for a DRM-free version going forward in the hopes that it will no longer be necessary to have to, you know, carve out exceptions to the copyright law for people with disabilities.
And my publisher, Tor Books, has announced that all of its books are DRM-free in all of its science fiction imprints around the world, U.S. Right. and everywhere else. Largest science fiction publisher in the world.
I love this. Will Wheaton spent $242. Not Will Wheaton spent $242. And Will Wheaton's clown sweaters spent $242.
Yes.
So you got a big fan with Will Wheaton.
Well, I mean, I think the other two are not Will. I think the other two are just people who follow Will around on behalf of his sweater and donate money.
But wait a minute, Corey. It's odd that they all gave the same amount.
Well, I think they did it so they could bracket him on the leaderboard.
Oh, they did. One was a little more and one was a little less.
That's right. One gave one penny more, one gave one penny
less.
That's
bizarre.
Bracket him on the leaderboard just to be, you
so
know.
So they could be next to their friend.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that is neat. Obviously, I didn't spend enough to make it to the leaderboard.
You can go and add more money.
I'm going to have to revise my contribution. And then you can get it in PDF, Mobi, or EPUB.
That's right.
Awesome. Yeah, look at all these books I just got.
And the humble folks, they're 501c3. You know, they're a nonprofit. They only do it because they want to make it better for people who make media to directly reach their audiences without having to be jerks.
Neat. Oh, and it makes it even easier to send it to your Kindle. They just give you the whole thing right there. That's awesome.
Well, Leo, you've done this to a degree too, right? You said you weren't going to take a salary. You were only going to go on the tips that
people
left.
Yeah, that didn't work out so well.
It didn't work. Okay. All right.
No, we do. You know, what happened was it was just complicated. So we just put it in the general fund. But I take a salary roughly equal to that times five. And then and then what we've done lately is we just sold some T-shirts to raise money for an elemental stuff. We're not giving it to charity. I'm the charity. But, I got to make a living.
Yeah. You're living in California. It's expensive up there.
And then I spend the money on things like the Humble Bundle, you see? Humblebundle.com.
It's the trickle-down theory.
It's trickle-down.
Right.
Make me rich. Yep. That's yeah, right. And I'll promise I'll give a small percentage to worthy charities.
But will you take a tax raise? I mean, you pay more taxes.
I pay more than 40%. I'm no 14%er.
Okay. All right.
I am giving much of my money to the federal and state governments in this fine land
so
of ours.
In California.
Yeah. California is more than 9% now. It's ridiculous.
No, I know. I did my taxes yesterday, actually, and I could see the California piece.
Yeah.
You know, as they cut the federal budget, the states start taxing you more.
Right.
You pay one way or the other.
I pay double tax on that because there's no tax relief if you live in the UK. So I pay tax on it in California and in the
yeah,
UK.
Yeah, but you don't have to pay for health insurance in the UK.
That's true. That's
true. A great deal.
Well, I do through my taxes, but yes.
Right. Well, that's okay.
That's right. That's right.
Hey, I'm excited about the new boxy TV for cord cutters. This is awesome. An HDTV antenna and a DVR. This was leaked, but I think it's true, and I know people are talking about it. This is a boxy box that you add your own storage to, and it will do DVR. And if you live near an HDTV signal, who needs the cable? Mm-hmm. Very, very cool.
Leo, did you see that there are two new Sling boxes came out this week?
I did.
Does anybody care?
I care. I care, yeah, because they're a sponsor.
Oh, excuse me.
Shut up. I care a lot.
So the question is, I mean, but it's a really interesting question about how important is it
they're waning. That's right.
To get access to your broadcast versus over the top anyway.
I think you still need it, but especially if you are paying for cable, what it does is it gives you what you really want. And someday we'll all have, which is any of our content, anytime, anywhere, in any form, on any device.
And it's really good when you're out of the country. So, for example, Corey from the UK, if you had a Sling box perched in someone's house here in the U.S., you could actually watch U.S. content if you wanted to.
But I agree with you. I dream of a day.
I had it like TV, but yes.
I dream of a day where Sling box won't be needed.
Right.
Someday the children can play and green fields, and there will be no need for a Sling box.
And Big Bird will be roaming free.
That's right. But until that day, we still need a Sling box. All right. You know what? Let me do a last commercial here, and we can wrap it up pretty quick. There's a few more stories. I want to ask you about your Singularity novel, too, Corey. I don't want to forget that. But first, a quick word from a nice Canadian company, just like you. It's from up Ontario way, up your way. It's called FreshBooks. This is one of the first Web 2.0 services I ever used. Amber MacArthur introduced me to this in 2004 because I was moaning and groaning about the fact that I had to invoice clients. I hated the end of the month. I never wanted to do invoices. But you know what? I found out an interesting lesson. You don't invoice, you don't get paid. In fact, I think the day that she told me about FreshBooks was the day I said I forgot to invoice Rogers, who was paying for the TV show, for like 6 months. And they said, well, we're not going to. That's 6 months ago. You want us to pay you now? So I realized, you know, I really should probably get these out in a more pronto fashion. FreshBooks was the solution. It's awesome. Cloud accounting. 5 million people use FreshBooks to make billing completely painless. It's so much easier to get paid with FreshBooks.com. They have a new iPhone app that will track expenses, turn hours into invoices on the go. You can actually do almost anything you could do on FreshBooks on the new iPhone app. Create invoices easily, email to clients. Clients love them because not only can they view the invoices online, they can pay you on the spot with a credit card, PayPal, one of the online authorization systems. Timesheets automatically become invoices, and your accountant will love you around tax time because you get all the important stuff to them in a form and fashion they can use. Even automated late payment reminders for those few clients who just don't pay right away. And, of course, as with all Canadian companies, you can call or email FreshBooks and get a live person, and they will respond instantly. I don't know what it is about Canada, but customer service, spot on. I think it's because they're nice. They're nice people, and they just want to help you. If you want to send physical invoices, they can do that too. They'll print them for an additional fee, print them, stamp them, and mail them. FreshBooks.com. You sign up right now. You get 30 days of unlimited use. All the features, clients, staff, everything. No limits at FreshBooks.com. Free for 30 days. Just make sure you say, I heard it on Twit when they ask you during sign up. Sign up today. 30 days of unlimited use. FreshBooks.com. I can vouch for it. A great service. Started using it 8 years ago. Wow. FreshBooks.
That's my biggest problem as a writer is I forget to send invoices. I'm really good about getting my articles in, really bad about getting my invoices in.
It's the worst thing. It's why I'm glad I'm no longer a freelancer. Thank goodness. Yep. I work for myself. I don't invoice myself, however, so I never get paid. So, Corey, tell me what is it called, the book you wrote?
Rapture of the Nerds.
Rapture of the Nerds.
Well, we'd written a couple of novellas over the years that have been very widely read and reprinted called Jury Service and Appeals Court. And our publisher asked us to write a third one that was as long as the first two put together and then some, called Parole Board. And they were published with a complete rewrite as one volume called Rapture of the Nerds. And it's basically a kind of madcap rush through a world where the singularity has already happened. And the only people left behind on the planet are people who didn't want to upload their minds for one reason or another. Either they have deeply held religious beliefs, or they're technophobes, or deep greens, or they're skeptical about this whole thing about having their, top of their head sliced off and their brain, scanned, destructively scanned and uploaded to the cloud. So periodically, the cloud of post-humanity sends sort of get evolved quick schemes to Earth via the RF spectrum, and various people who should know better download them and try to instantiate them on Earth. And when they do and they get caught, there's a tech jury that meets in Libya and to evaluate their technology. And so Hugh is a kind of deep green Welsh potter who hates the singularity. His parents have both ascended and he resents them. And he's called to tech jury in Libya, where he's infected with alien technology.
Oh, man.
And sort of the rest unfolds from there through the next two volumes. And there's surprise appearances by various famous philosophers and so on and so forth. There's a great scene where he's sitting in his pottery and working on a pot, and there's a thump at the door, and he says, "Who is it?" And this booming voice says, "It's the singularity." And he says, "What do you want?" And he says, "Everything is different now." And he says, "I don't want any."
I love it. That sounds great.
Charlie's a very funny guy, so writing this book with him was hilarious.
Rapture of the Nerds, available at craphound.com and everywhere else.
And from Tor Books, yeah.
Tor Books. Tor is a great publisher. It's a great site.
They're awesome.
So I think because you're in Britain, you're probably more aware of this Gary McKinnon story than we are here in the States. Gary McKinnon, a British computer hacker, on Tuesday will learn his fate. He's been fighting for 10 years against U.S. extradition for hacking the Pentagon. On Tuesday, the Home Secretary will announce her decision to Parliament on whether McKinnon will be extradited. Why is there controversy on this?
Well, you know, he's this autistic spectrum guy who has trouble functioning in outside society. He basically probed an American military server, reported a security vulnerability, didn't do anything bad, is basically being extradited as a kind of terrorist. And there's, you know, I think legitimate fear that he's going to end up in kind of Bradley Manningville in a mm-hmm. kind of, you know, solitary confinement, naked and freaked out kind of indefinitely. And so, yeah, Brits are pretty worried about it. It seems pretty clear that what he did was not the kind of thing that actually was done with any sort of malice and presented any kind of risk. It was just against the rules. And I think it's pretty, I would bet that he's going to end up being extradited. I don't think the Tories are likely to keep him in Britain.
That's kind of sad.
They're going to send him off. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason they call them the Nasty Party.
What is the view in the UK of the US, our kind of attitude towards homeland security? It sounds like the Brits are somewhat afraid of it.
Well, it's not unitary, right? I mean, it's spread it across the city. We are the country with 14
you got more
CCTVs
cameras.
Per red
yeah.
blood cell. Yeah. yeah. So it's on the one hand, I think there's this sense, oh, you know, the Americans are mad. They fingerprint you when you come into the country. And on the other hand, you know, when we kind of lead America in things like network surveillance and CCTVs, and we actually rescinded habeas corpus, right? It's in the Magna Carta. But
hey,
we don't
so
have,
do we. You know, what the hell?
You know, but they can actually, like, hold you, I think it was for 14 days. Eventually, they kind of, I think they backed off on it, but they could hold you for 14 days without trial. You know, we don't have a First Amendment, so there's lots of people who get busted for very weird things like making jokes on Twitter about,
yes,
you know,
we talked about that last week.
Blowing up their
planes
and stuff. Yeah. So, you know, it's, I think that Britons who are moderately self-aware understand that they are living in a very glassy house, and that they have no business telling Americans that they've gone security mad when Britain's gone justice security mad. And I think that there's a sizable portion of Britons who seem to vote for this stuff, and who for whom, you know, a security puppet show is just as good as security, and you know, bulk surveillance just keeps the bastards from misbehaving. And you know, it's rather a pity, I think, to use a British phrase.
And yet there's clearly mistrust of the U.S. and what we might do with Gary.
Sure, although, you know, there's the special relationship. I think when it comes to a head is when, you remember the people who tweeted that
yeah.
they were coming to New York to
dig up Marilyn Monroe.
L.A., yeah, they're going to dig up Marilyn Monroe's grave. It was clearly just hyperbole. I mean, it was
right.
tasteless, but it was like no more tasteless.
It was
tasteless
a joke.
Yeah, it was, you know, I mean, they say sillier things in American Pie movies, right?
Right.
And yet they were turned back. And I think at that point, you know, notwithstanding the Nottingham Airport incident, a lot of people were like, seriously? Really? Like, you can't tell the difference between an actual terrorist and someone who says, I'm coming to get so loaded in L.A. that I'm going to end up digging up Marilyn's grave? like, because if you can't tell the difference between those things, I think you're doomed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you know, yeah. you're going to spend a lot of time chasing drunk people, and you're going to be so busy, you're going to miss the guy planning to blow up something for real.
Right.
So, but again, We're the ones who chased this guy, you know, who said, oh, if my girlfriend's late coming into Nottingham Airport again next week, I'm going to blow the place up. In a tweet that nobody saw until weeks later. And then, you know, nobody took seriously, but some prosecutor decided they should do something about it.
He won his case, though, just recently.
He did, eventually. Years. I mean, he lost his job. Yeah. His life was destroyed. He didn't win his case because the government were like, you know, you're right. That was just dumb of us. He won the case because eventually it got to a judge who said, Really? No.
No.
You know?
Sorry. You're going to love this. Nathan Myhrvold, former Microsoft CTO and world-renowned yeah. patent troll, has just patented DRM for 3D objects.
Oh, no.
He's very worried, as I think all right-minded people are, that people with a MakerBot might just, I don't know, make something that's patented. So he's got a patent Tuesday from the USPTO. Manufacturing Control System describes methods for managing object production rights, DRM, for 3D printers.
I call prior art because this appeared in my short story Theme Punks, which became my novel Makers, and was serialized on Salon. That's a 2008.
This must be filing. Depressing. The world is coming
true. I'm pretty sure it was serialized on Salon in 2007, so I call prior art.
The dystopia you imagined in 2007 is becoming real. Corey, great to have you.
It took Nostradamus to predict it, right?
So great to have you. Let's actually, before we wrap up, let's say hello to Tom Mayer, find out what's coming up in the week ahead, what stories we'll be covering on TNT Tech News Today. Tom?
Hey, thanks, Leo. Here's a look at some of the things we'll be keeping an eye on in the week ahead for Tech News Today. On Monday, October 15th, PubCon starts and runs through the 18th in Las Vegas, Nevada. Tuesday, October 16th, IBM has their earnings and TwilioCon takes place. Wednesday, October 17th, eBay has their earnings call. And Google Wallet is set to phase out its prepaid card. That's the cutoff date, so use it up. Also, the Dublin Web Summit takes place that day, and it's IMDb's birthday. Thursday, October 18th, it's Earnings Palooza. Microsoft, Nokia, Google, and Verizon all set to announce their earnings, and it's the Nintendo NES's birthday. Finally, Friday, October 19th, anyone buying Office 2010 or Office for Mac 2011 will also qualify for an upgrade to the equivalent version of Office 2013 starting on Friday, October 19th. That's a look at the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
And I just bought Office 2010. Darn it. No.
Derp.
Just kidding. Just kidding. Cory Doctorow is, of course, one of the founding editors of Boing Boing. BoingBoing.net is a great site for wonderful things, and we love it very much. We're always eternally grateful. Of course, his books are just taken off. You can't stop writing them. You can find out more at his own website, craphound.com. And absolutely, pick up a copy. It's a young adult, right?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, sort of 13 and up or 11 and up if you've got a really precocious young person.
If you want to radicalize your teenager, do so now with Cinema Pirates, available everywhere. Thank you, Corey.
I'll put up bail for him.
It's really great to have you on. Pirate Cinema. I've reversed it. I'm dyslexic. Pirate Cinema. Thank you, Corey. Good to have you.
Thank you, Leo.
Jason Heiner is the man in charge of Tech Republic, techrepublic.com, a great place to get analysis of tech news, particularly with regard to kind of enterprise, right?
Yep. So I write for Tech Republic, ZDNet, and CNET as well. So writing about Tech Republic and ZDNet are mostly the business of technology, and CNET is consumer technology. So you can find me on all three.
It's great to have you again, Jason. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. You helped me get elected president of the internet. And I'm very grateful, but I understand somebody else is running now, that guy from Reddit. So go ahead. He can have the job.
Yeah.
It's a sinecure anyway.
Yeah. It's a lifetime
term. Is it? Oh, all right. Take that, Alex Ohanian. And we thank Larry Magid from CBS Radio. It's great to have you. Larry'sWorld.com, a great site, a good place to find out how to set your privacy on iOS 6, because it's not where you think it is. Thank you, Larry, for being here.
It's really a pleasure, Leo. Thanks always a lot. Fun. And great to meet you other guys, too.
Yeah. I got a baseball game to go to or watch.
Oh, baseball.
Yeah, I think the Giants are playing. I'm excited. But thank you all for being here. We do this show every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time on twit.tv. You can watch live. We love it if you do. But if you can't, of course, we make audio and video versions available on demand after the fact on the website, twit.tv, or wherever fine podcasts are aggregated. We do hope you will make it a regular visit to the Twit Network. Thanks to our producer, Chad Johnson. Thank you, Corey. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Larry. Thank you for being here. Another Twit
This is amazing.
Is in the can.